to have a public hearing, but I misspoke and didn't have that put on the agenda, so I am going to provide an opportunity for anyone who would like to come up and to speak to do that during our work session. What I intend to do today is to go through a preliminary staff measure summary, actually ask you two gentlemen to come up and join us and to have us as a working group begin to go through House Bill 3458. So that's the plan today. Let's see how far we can go. Let's see what questions we have. Again, I would share with this committee that my full intention is to work in a very bipartisan manner for the best interest of Oregonians, and let's do our best to try and reach consensus on those issues that are important to Oregonians and to bring in integrity to this process. So I'd start off with Cletus sharing the preliminary staff measure summary of what House Bill 3458 is.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3458 increases the maximum amount of civil penalty for violation of law prohibiting conversion of excess political campaign funds to personal use to $750 plus amount converted to personal use. It directs all candidates and political committees to file electronic statements of contributions received and expenditures made with Secretary of State not later than 7 calendar days after contributions received or expenditures made. It also directs the committee to make all expenditures through account treasurer to deposit all contributions in account, existing political committee to establish account and amend statement of organization not later than September 30, 2005. It also directs the Secretary of State to conduct reviews of contributions and expenditure statements filed with the Secretary, and also directs the Secretary of State to make contributions and expenditure data available to the public on Internet according to schedule adopted by the Secretary of State's rules. It prohibits the candidate or candidate's principal campaign committee from making payment to candidate from campaign funds in consideration of professional services performed by the candidate. It prohibits deposit of other monies in account. It prohibits person holding public office from making payment to person from person's principal campaign committee to reimburse person for specific expenses for which person has been reimbursed by public body. It requires the candidates and political committee to file copies of financial institution account statements with political contribution and expenditure statements. It requires the candidates and political committees to report business name and location of payees of expenditures made by the candidate or committee. It requires the civil penalty to be paid from personal funds of the person against whom penalty is assessed. It requires the committee to maintain account in name of committee. It requires the committee to specify location and name of account in statement of organization, and requires political committee to establish exclusive campaign account and financial institution. It sets January 1st, 2007, operative date for electronic filing provisions, and sets operative date for filing requirements within the statement, and it declares emergency effective on passage.
Terrific. Thank you. Again, my intention was to have a public hearing, and unfortunately, because of my error, that did not get stated. So I do want to allow folks in the audience to have an opportunity to come up and to share their thoughts with us. I see we have the Democratic leader with us, and we would welcome you up.
Chairman Smith and members of the committee, I'm Jeff Merkley, House Democratic leader and representative from House District 47. It's a pleasure to be here. I wanted to come as you kick off the discussion of House Bill 3458. I want to start by applauding the creation of this subcommittee. In the four sessions that I've been here, this is the first time I've been in a room where we had two Democrats and two Republicans serving on a committee in perfect balance. And that was Representative Kitt's vision, as so well restated by Representative Smith, of a bipartisan process on this important issue. And I really want to applaud both the philosophical sentiment, but then converting that into a very real statement by the way this committee has been put together. I think that the bill that you're looking at has many significant components related to the integrity of the legislature and the transparency of the political process to the citizens of the state. So it's a very important opportunity to do some very valuable work. And so I'm pleased that the committee has begun to work on these issues, and I want to offer my help in any way that I can. It's critical that we take strong steps to regain public trust, and we have the opportunity for those strong steps through this legislation. I will offer a couple comments. One is that all the bills that have been drafted in an attempt to take on this issue are in various ways related to campaign finance statements and expenditures and reconciliation between statements and expenditures. There is an issue that is different in some of the individual bills that were crafted and submitted with both D's and R's as co-sponsors, in this issue between reviews as called for in HB 3458 and audits as called for in House Bill 3322 and 3298, of which Representative Scott and myself are the chief sponsors. So that's one issue that may take some effort to examine. A second is that our colleagues in the Senate are immersed in working on the timely disclosure portions, and that is a very messy, complicated issue. And so I just urge collaboration with the Senate in trying to figure out how to solve this problem. And if it starts to become something that slows down the rest of the bill, it might be an opportunity to take that piece and address it in one of the separate bills that was crafted on it and continue work on the rest. Because I think that we did promise the state collectively, as these now is a timely urgent consideration of these issues, and we certainly want to keep that on track. So thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee as you kick off the process, and I wish you happy deliberations.
Perfect. Thank you. Any questions for the Democratic leader? You're more than welcome to come join us as we go page by page through it.
I would love to. I'm afraid I'm unable to.
Have a great day. Colleagues, one of the thoughts I had the last time we came together was anything that we pass out of this committee and perhaps eventually becomes law is something we're all going to have to live with. It's not going to affect a Republican more than a Democrat or a Democrat more than a Republican. So I think with that said, we ought to just roll up our sleeves and start getting into House Bill 3458. I'm going to ask if you gentlemen could come up and introduce yourselves for the record.
They all look very excited to be here, don't they, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I'm Ted Raylinger. I am the election law drafter in the Legislative Council's office. And if you would like, I'm prepared to go through the bill section by section.
Perfect. Mr. Chairman, I'm John Lundback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. We have a few brief comments on some drafting issues of the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ben Neal, Campaign Finance Manager for the Elections Division. I'm here for technical support.
Well, colleagues, how do you want to proceed forward? Do you want to start off with the Elections Division, let them share their comments with us, and then move into the bill, or do you want to hold them as we go through the bill and get their comments afterwards?
Maybe, Mr. Chair, I would assume that some of their comments might be very technical issues. Maybe those could be held, but some of them might be more global comments. I don't know.
You want to share with us...
Actually, most of our comments today are related to specific language in the bill that we think needs some clarification in order to aid our enforcement. I'm happy to wait until you after you get an explanation from the drafter and whatever would be easiest for you.
Once again, committee, what is your preference for moving through House Bill 3458? Do you want to get an overview and then move into a page by page? Do you just want to do a page by page?
I think we've all done an overview, haven't we, personally?
I want to make sure that this committee is comfortable with whatever we pass out of here up to the rules committee.
I'd be comfortable just starting page by page and going through it and having Mr. Lindbeck or Mr. Neal or Legislative Council, you know, pop in when they have a particular problem with a language or a particular different point of view. And likewise, if any committee members has a problem or a different point of view on that language, that we talk about it right then and move on to the next section.
Why don't you lead us off then and take us through the bill? And I would encourage committee members, as they have questions, to stop, ask a question, and let's deal with the issue.
Mr. Chair, again, Ted Reutlinger, Legislative Counsel's Office. The bill is organized to follow the joint press release that was issued by the Speaker and Representative Merkley, and so it follows in basically the same order. So, to start off, the first thing on the press release was to increase the fine for violations of the statute that prohibits the conversion of campaign funds to personal use. So the first section in this bill simply amends the civil penalty section in the election laws to add an enhanced civil penalty for violation of the personal use statute. It moves it up to $750 plus the amount that's converted to personal use in violation of the law. Under existing law, if you violate the statute on personal use of campaign funds, the maximum civil penalty is $250. So this is a fairly substantial increase in the amount of penalty that the Secretary of State can impose, and it's a maximum civil penalty as the way it's written now. The bill is drafted so that this provision takes effect immediately on passage. The emergency clause applies to this section. It also, at the end of Section 1, adds some language that says that if a candidate violates the personal use statute and a civil penalty is imposed against the candidate, then the candidate is personally liable to pay that amount out of their own funds. They can't pay it out of campaign funds.
Share with me the rationale for having the use of the word or afterwards, $1,000 or. That leaves it to the discretion of the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you're talking page 1, line 15.
Right.
The or in that case is really not relevant to what we're trying to accomplish here. And the reason is this. The subsection 1 of that statute sets the general rule of $250 civil penalty for all election law violations. Then subsection 2 is the section that has all of the enhanced penalties. So you can see right now, under existing law, there on line 15, Secretary of State already has the authority to impose a $1,000 penalty for violations of those two statutes listed there. So the or is basically just a transition there.
Could this committee, and please committee, I want this to be a working group. Let's just ask our questions as we move forward. Could this group have said $1,000 plus the amount converted to personal use for each violation and just tie those two together?
Chair, certainly you could. If you wanted to change the dollar amount there, that would be an easy fix to make.
Mr. Chair, Fred Neal here. I think you're trying to combine the new paragraph A and the new paragraph B by coming up with the same dollar amount of penalty. The 251 provisions are the that's violation of changing a statement of endorsement for a voter's pamphlet argument, a candidate statement. And so there's no amount of money involved there. It's just simply a civil penalty that's higher than the $250 generally for an election law violation.
Thank you. That clarifies for me. Thank you.
I have a clarification. When you put an of state in parentheses and deleted the of state behind secretary, I assume that's just for, we're still referring to the Secretary of State there. It's just,
yes.
You got tired of saying Secretary of State every time.
That's legislative council foreman style. That's what our foreman style manual tells us to do. That's adopted by the body by rule. So whenever we find things that don't conform to foreman style in old statutes, we attempt to fix them. So those are just technical cleanup. Okay. Section 3 of the bill responds to item number 2 on the joint press release. That is the one that addresses the issue of commingling of funds. It requires all PACs and candidates to set up a single account in a financial institution. It requires that the name of the PAC be listed on the name of the records of the financial institution. It requires you to put all contributions that you receive into that account. It requires that you make all expenditures out of that account.
It allows you to make expenditures from the account with a check, a debit card, or some other form of electronic transfer. It prohibits a candidate or PAC from putting any private money into that account. That account should contain only contributions that the candidate or PAC has received.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Currently, there's a provision to allow for loans, personal loans, to be made to your PAC for campaign purposes. Is that still, does this wipe that out, that provision or ability out?
Mr. Chair, it's simple answer, no. It simply would require that when you make a loan to your campaign that you deposit that loan into this account and then make expenditures from the account. This provision for existing PACs, including principal campaign committees, takes effect immediately, so anybody who's in the system now would have to establish this account by September 30th, 2005.
What's the logic on the financial institution must be located in the state and must ordinarily conduct business with the general public in the state? What's the rationale of that?
I believe the rationale for that is to prevent somebody from setting up a financial institution solely for the purpose of accepting campaign money, basically. It's designed to require candidates and PACs to establish accounts in regular banks, credit unions that are accepting deposits, making loans.
You can just say an FDIC account.
I suppose you could do that. I'm not sure if that would prevent the establishment of a financial institution that's set up simply to deal with one or more campaign finance accounts, which is, I think, what that language was aimed at.
The other question I have is on line 5, page 3, all expenditures made by the political committee shall be drawn from the campaign account. Does that mean you can no longer reimburse yourself? I have $5. I go to McDonald's and I hand $5. Can I no longer turn that receipt in and get paid back $5?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't read this to prohibit that. It would simply say that there's an expenditure that has to come out of that account.
They're nodding their head here.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. That is one of the questions that we had with this section, is that you may want to be clear about that, because it looks to us like it would disallow reimbursement for small cash expenditures by a candidate or minor office expenditures. So we had that precise example we were talking about. If you were driving to some campaign event and whipped through the McDonald's drive-thru and spent $5 on a burger and you had cash, you'd have to use a debit card or a credit card in order to buy that lunch. And that may not be the intent, but it would be good, I think, to make that clear.
Representative, you have that?
Yeah, I don't have the ORS. Back to the bottom of page 2, I don't have that ORS 706. Does that include both credit unions and banks under that particular statute?
Mr. Chair, I believe it does. That's the broadest definition of financial institution.
Right.
What's the committee's thought on all expenditures made by the political committee shall be drawn from the campaign account?
I think it's, you've got to allow the cash reimbursement.
Yeah.
I don't see how that's practical to not allow that. As much, although personal completes my CDs, tells me never spend any cash, I'm not going to reimburse you for it. That's why I carry a credit card on mine, but because it's a nightmare to file that extra form, but I think you've got to allow it. So certainly there'll be some provision to allow it.
I can share with you, Mr. Morgan, quite often there's places that don't accept credit cards. And so it's cash.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the expenses that my treasurer does not reimburse me for.
In regards to the credit card, is the credit card, when you mentioned using a credit card, is that credit card supposed to be issued to the campaign or to the candidate personally? Or is there a definition of whose credit card we're able to use?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, it refers to a debit card, which I would assume would be a card that applies to this specific account. So if you were using your own personal credit card, that might be a problem under this statute. It would be a card that's tied directly to the account.
That maybe I read it the first time a different way then. I read it as being a debit card or another form of electronic transaction, which could be a credit card. Like I have an exclusive credit card for my campaign that I only use for campaign expenses and is paid off in full by a check from my campaign. Would that be allowed under this?
Mr. Chair, I would think it would if the credit card was tied to the single campaign account. Again, that's a detail that we may want to clarify in this legislation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hutt, I'm not sure that we would read that where we're trying to implement this because it says the controlling language is shall be drawn from the campaign account and so we think it would simply be a debit card or, you know, electronic, I don't know, suppose over the web transaction with that account and the vendor and not a personal credit card by anyone else, because unless that again, that gets us to this other another point that comes to all contributions, direct or indirect, being deposited in the account. And if somebody paid for something with their own credit card and said that's an in-kind contribution for this good or service we purchased, that's not going through this bank account either. And so we have a question about what happens to in-kind contributions. Are they disallowed? But that's another issue.
I guess I'm of the opinion frankly that, you know, there has to be a balance where you allow reimbursement and you allow circumstances where 20 minutes before the parade you're able to go write a check to get the balloons or what have you, and then you reimburse with a receipt the check you wrote. That's my take on this.
I tend to agree with you there.
I agree.
I don't know where Dave's at on that, but
but
practically speaking, if you've ever run a campaign, it's logistically almost impossible to write a check for everything you do.
And by the same token, I think having the option to, in a similar way, pay by credit card for something and then have that reimbursed, presumably in that case directly by the campaign. I mean, my campaign will cut a check to my credit card company, so I'm not the middle person at all. The credit card, which is exclusively for the campaign, bears the expense. My campaign account cuts a check to the credit card company, so I never see the cash at all. Seems like something like that's got to be allowed in addition to the reimbursement for some cash expenses.
Are you suggesting that the credit card, are we all suggesting as we look at this that the credit card has to have the name of the campaign on it? Because sometimes those take some time to turn around, and I, you know, got into the campaign game pretty late, just about a year ago, essentially, and I had to wait for a campaign, you know, a credit card, it might have been, the primary would have been over. And additionally, when we sometimes have to order things over the phone and give credit cards, it seems to me if you can provide documentation proving and you have an audit trail available for review, that should be what the goal is, whether no matter whose name it was in.
I wonder if the Secretary of State has any comments. Have you witnessed problems with personal reimbursement with the use of credit cards in the past?
Well, I don't know that we've witnessed problems where people were doing things wrong, but we certainly had a lot of questions about it. And, you know, that seems to be something that gets scrutinized by people, and so they seem to care about it, and a clear trail would be helpful.
I don't understand, though, is the difference, help me, the difference between cash, check, and credit card. So long as you have a receipt, backing up verification of your use of the money.
Well, Fred Neal here, just to clarify that, what the bill is attempting to do, as we read it, is to say all campaign monies have to go through a dedicated bank account. And that's what it says. It does not account for, or clearly accommodate, minor cash purchases made by the candidate, minor office incidental expenses. You've got to hurry up and get a copy of something to file with the Secretary of State, and Kinko's isn't going to take a check for 85 cents.
Can't you take all, where it says any all expenditures, couldn't you put something like all actual and reimbursed expenditures made by the political committee shall be drawn?
Well, I think the legislative council can draft whatever the committee wants. This just tells how much flexibility you want in this dedication of a bank account. And I'm sure Ted can come up with language. We can help him with that.
We do encourage a clear trail, because here's what happens is that when folks are out there scrutinizing candidate reports and they see lots and lots of small expenditures, it does raise questions about personal use. And so you want to be able to prove that these were actually campaign expenditures, and a clear trail will help any candidate do that.
We would probably also recommend, and we can just certainly do it by rule, mileage logs, so that there's a written paper trail of that, because that's not a out-of-pocket expenditure. It's a per-mile reimbursement to the campaign manager, the candidate, or the treasurer for mileage. And so a mileage log is the only way to really substantiate that and provide a paper
trail. The problem with that, though, is for your rural legislators who only pay themselves reimburse themselves on receipts, all of a sudden their campaign's going to be paying them a heck of a lot more money. And for some of us, that's not what we want. If I got paid mileage, I can make a living off of it.
Yeah, I think Mr. Neal was saying that even in a case where there is a mileage reimbursement, there should be a mileage log.
Oh, right.
Only where the report's showing a reimbursement. That's the paper trail we'd have there. And then so, and obviously that anyway, reimbursement is going to come out of a campaign account.
Got it. I get it. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, that we also should have dedicated accounts already, but some of these things apparently have to be put in a statute.
We would like a paper trail of petty cash expenditures, but I think we're used to candidates being used to having our measure campaigns having an office petty cash fund, and we just they can't write an expenditure to cash.
Can I summarize this, though, as saying that we want a dedicated account, and we want to make sure that there's receipts to verify the expenditures made out of the account. Is that?
I would agree with that, but I'd also like to ask, should there, when we're talking about, because I think we should make an allowance for personal reimbursement for these petty expenditures. I mean, that's my goal in addressing this, but should we state a limit of what a petty cash or what a reimbursement, should there be a limit on it? Like, should it be $50? Should it be $100? Or should it be $300? Or, $1,000? I'm just wondering if there's a thought on that, because personally I think, for me, if I have an expense that's going to be more than $100, I'm usually trying to plan ahead on it far enough that, I've got a check available. But for running to the donut shop or making copies sometimes with a campaign staff or a volunteer, you don't always have that ability to be everywhere in a campaign to write a check. So
Well, and also, you don't always have, I'm sorry if I interrupted you.
No.
Also, I was talking about earlier, sometimes you need to order supplies or something over the phone, and having that, sometimes they won't accept you sending a check later. Sometimes time's a factor, and utilizing a personal credit card, as long as it just seems like the whole goal is to have documentation clear, and you know, compelling evidence that you did what you did for real purposes with the campaign.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm a little uncomfortable with, you know, and I don't know financial institutions, if it's hard to get a credit card for a campaign committee, first of all, but I haven't checked into that, but I know sometimes it's hard just to open up a campaign account with financial institutions. But I would clearly like to have campaign credit cards for those sorts of instances where you're purchasing big ticket items, like, you know, you got to call, you know, some other city to order your lawn signs, for example, you know, that could cost, you know, $3,000 or something like that. And,
you know, the dilemma though is, what if one of the candidates has poor credit? He can't get credit cards. Maybe a great legislator, but can't get a credit card.
Oh.
I'm willing to bet in the 90 members here, odds are.
There's somebody out there.
Mr. Chair, can I add a comment here? I think the drafting specifically mentions debit cards. I don't know that it specifically mentions credit cards. I think there's a difference. I think most banks issue a debit card with an account. It allows you to draw directly on the account with a card.
Over the phone.
It's a little different.
Yeah.
I mean, instead of billing you once a month, the money just goes directly out of your account.
All right. And I guess the use of a credit card implies that you could go into debt as mm-hmm. well, which I don't know if there's a law against that.
No.
As a campaign.
law against that.
What I'm trying to wrap my arms around is, what's the difference between utilizing a personal credit card to get something for the campaign or you still have to pay a check, you know, you write a check out of your campaign finance PAC account to pay whichever credit card it is, and they still could be for the same purpose. Why do we want to limit ourselves and not... I'm just trying to figure out what the difference would be between those two, really. You're still having to write a check out of your committee bank account to pay the bill.
Right.
Whether to reimburse yourself because it was a credit card, your personal credit card, or to pay the bill directly to...
It would somewhat go under accounts payable, I suppose.
It's going in there, yeah.
Because there's the delay from the time you actually purchase it with the credit card and the time you write write a campaign, you know, 30, 60 days later to pay for the item.
I said we saw that in the reporting scheme by saying that the transaction itself is the purchase of goods, whether it's by the candidate's credit card or by check from the account, and that's when it's reported. And so, and we always have to work with people on the phone when they start to pay their Visa bill. Says, no, we don't want to see you're paying that because you've already reported the expenditures in your when you made the purchase, or the candidate made the purchase, and it shows up on their PC3A of their personal expenditures for reimbursement. So it is tricky to walk people through credit card transactions. I think debit cards are simpler, and I think they're probably more universal to accounts, and they're only as good as the money that's in the account. But I agree, certainly, we understand that candidates and other campaigns have the need to make some expenditures that aren't convenient to pay by check, or the vendor may not really want, won't be convenient to them or the committee. So you might want to make some accommodation, both for expenditures made by the candidate. Obviously, if we need substantiation of it, you better keep a paper trail. And also for incidental office expenses as well.
I would check the committee. Once again, my thoughts are, you know, we need a dedicated account We want receipts of all expenditures and deposit slips of all deposits. That's my take.
Paper trail.
Yep.
Can I raise some questions with Section 4, or would this be an appropriate time to do that?
Section 3.
It would be sub 4, lines 10 through 12 on page 3.
Section 3.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Section 3.
You're still on Section 3. Okay,
right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. If that's appropriate.
Please, yeah, of course.
Okay. This section says that a contribution received by a candidate or the treasurer of a political committee directly or indirectly shall be deposited by the treasurer into the campaign account not later than 10 days after the date the contribution is received. One question that raised for us is this: does this mean that only the treasurer can make deposits? Can't the candidate do it, or the candidate's spouse on a way down to the campaign event or whatever? You probably want to address that in terms of clarity. Also, the 10 days conflicts with our requirement that campaign accounts be kept up to date within 7 days. And it would be good to sort of keep those both the same.
Could I ask, that the 7 days is current statute?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I know we mentioned that and people go, oh.
Yeah, we
don't
start.
And then the other one is our committee's allowed, well, Fred already mentioned that, our committee's allowed to receive in-kind contributions as they can't be deposited, so you may want to make some sort of allowance for in-kind contributions.
Again, committee, my take on this is I just want to know there's a deposit slip. There's a deposit slip behind the deposit. Whether it's my kid who runs it down to the bank or my treasurer or me, I just want to make sure that there's a deposit slip behind it. And if I was ever asked, I could verify
where it came from.
Yep.
Right. And I would suggest that you take the deposit. I'd take by the treasurer out myself and just shall be deposited into the campaign account not later than.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Now we're down to the 7 day, 10 day discussion. I don't know why. Do you know why we chose to change it to 10 days from 7? Does anybody have the history of that?
Mr. Chair, it's in Colby. If I were drafting this again, I would put it as 7 days to be consistent with the current requirement that your accounts be up to date within 7 days. So I would attribute that to just drafting oversight.
The one question I have is the definition of received. I'm out of town for 2 weeks. Date of the check says 2 weeks earlier. The letter says we're so proud to support you, and that's dated 3 weeks earlier. But I came home, got into my P.O. box, and there it is.
I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Chair. We've been working on that issue on the other side, on the Senate side, definition of received. And we have been working on some definitions because there is a lack of a bright line on that right now. And we'd be happy to propose a definition if you're
terrific.
Interested in that.
Yeah.
I always assumed it was when you open the post office box.
It's when you have physical custody of
right,
the contribution.
Right. When you gain physical custody of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I thought, but maybe I've been wrong.
but if I have a check that's dated a month earlier and a letter that's dated a month earlier and it's post-stamped or whatever that's called a month earlier, then it's incumbent upon me to prove that I didn't receive it a month earlier.
Representative Smith, Mr. Chair, Fred Neal again. The state has to prove by preponderance of evidence that there was an omission. Even in civil enforcement, so we'd have to show that somehow. I mean, that's maybe some circumstantial evidence, but why would we even?
Where has this been an issue somewhere?
No.
Well, we get questions about it, and then we try to explain it, and it always seems like the committees are left scratching their heads, which is why we were trying to address this on the other side when it came up. And so we'd be happy to come forward with a proposal for you, that would propose a brighter line.
First of all, maybe I'm just naive, but could you explain to me why there is a deadline? wouldn't you want to get the money into your account?
Well, yeah. It all came up from Measure 9 when you could only get $100 from an individual in X amount of time.
Oh.
And so,
that really doesn't
people
apply
would
anymore,
manipulate
then.
The time that they gave it or received it because of contribution limits. It's not relevant at all now, we don't think, because people want some money and they want to be able to spend it. You're absolutely right.
I think where it comes up, I'll just add one thing here. I think where it comes up is there's always suspicions that somebody's trying to hide last-minute contributions. And so if we have a bright line, it makes it a little easier for people to know exactly when received means received.
But it's still pretty subjective and unprovable, it sounds like, still.
Well, it is very difficult, and that's...
So the people that would be above board would be above board to begin with, and people who want to hide it could.
We'd look at the... If we were getting the bank records, and this is only if we requested them, if we'd look at when the deposit was actually made. That's the drop-dead bright line, if you will. But certainly they had it then, and did their report reflect having at least received it by that date?
Okay. What do you want to do in this committee?
Yeah.
I don't see the relevance of it. Again, that's my thought, but I'll go where the committee wants to go.
Well, that's what I was wondering. If it was a statute that harken back to another day when things were done a bit differently and now maybe doesn't apply. I don't know if it is relevant.
As far as receiving the contribution, I think it's when you physically have custody of it. I mean, to me, that's kind of cut and dry. And I don't know if there's other issues around that.
But do we still want the deadline? That's...
Within 10 days or 7 days.
The only plus I could see of it would be if there is an audit of the campaign that's done and you actually are requesting the bank statements at that point and you've got documents reporting contributions or not reporting them and the deposit dates are way off. I was actually not aware that there's a 10-day requirement for a 7-day requirement for depositing, because I can think of some post-campaign checks that I've, several weeks worth that have been deposited at once in a campaign I know well.
Your accounts have to be current.
Right, your account has to be current.
So as long as you've recorded in your own books that you got that contribution within 7 days of receiving it.
Oh, so it's
we don't first. Have bank account regulations at this point. But, I mean, some candidates...
Would apply it a step further. Okay. So I'm in compliance today. I wouldn't be in compliance with this yet.
Again, we're throwing out scenarios. What happens if I received a check from somebody I didn't want to cash? But I didn't want them to take that money and give it to someone else. Tobacco company. Right to life.
As long as you don't deposit it, there's no requirement that says you can't take a month to return it.
Actually, there is a law that says you have to return it within a certain number of days, isn't there?
Within 7 days or reported as received.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's not your money, it's somebody else's.
Well, is it a contribution if you don't deposit it?
Under current law, yes.
Yeah, you received it.
So
it might be running up accounts payable, to knowing that when that bill comes, you can cash the check.
Instead of saying deposited by the treasurer, saying reported as being received into the campaign account, not later than 7 days after the date the contribution is received.
Yeah, I think that's already in current statute, right?
Okay, so...
Reported as received within 7 days is
right.
This would just extend it.
Okay, well, then let's get rid of that. We don't have to worry about this.
So this would be a new requirement with the new required bank account that contributions be deposited within 10 or 7 days of receiving.
Okay. I still question the relevance, Mr. Chair, of depositing it within 7 days, but, you know, it doesn't matter. No, I'm going to get it there as soon as I can.
I have the opinion it's silly, but I'll go where you guys
wait to approve it. Just for fun.
Not a deal breaker for me either way.
You folks are the ones who have to...
Well, it does provide a paper. I was just thinking it does provide a paper trail that, indeed, the deposits being made. If we're trying to make sure that reports of contributions are reported in a timely fashion, that the bank deposit gives you another way of proving to us that you did it timely, because you've got that, the bank records, as well as your own ledger or log. And so it is a way, I think it helps campaigns have a paper trail for our enforcement purposes, as well as giving us something that assures us that you reported timely.
So to some degree, is that almost a corollary of a receipt for an expenditure? This would basically provide the receipt for a deposit.
Yeah.
Either way, you should be reporting it.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you
because otherwise all you have that we would require is a copy of the contribution itself, that we may want a copy of the back of it to see when it was endorsed or deposited into what bank account. But that's, again, other than your bank account statement, there's nothing else on the contribution side to substantiate it other than the contribution itself. And Representative Smith had the issue of, well, the check was written some time ago, and I didn't get it until they held their fundraiser or whatever. So,
and that does occur.
Yeah.
What practice is most in line with GAAP on this? Generally accepted accounting principles. What's the best way to do this?
Well, I think it would be cleaner. Are you talking about changing the 10 to 7? Is that what you're asking about?
I'm fine with that, if that's where we go.
I think we'd encourage you to change the 10 to 7, because I think it's just less confusing for people with the 7-day reporting requirement to keep with everything within that 7 days.
But do we need to change the word on contribution to cash contribution? Because, again, back on what about in-kind?
Let's just say other than in kind, a contribution other than in kind received.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that you put in some specific language that states exactly that this does not apply to an in kind contribution.
Is the committee okay with that?
Yeah,
we'll go there.
Where we need to go. I'd also like to reiterate that we're getting rid of it shall be deposited by the treasurer, because I think that limits us from getting money to the bank quite a bit on time.
Any other issue on Section 3?
Well, yes, on subsection 5, I'm still a little concerned when I read it and knowing how things get construed later from people who haven't participated in this process, that if the campaign account cannot include private monies, it needs to define... I'm just worried about not being able to make a private money loan to it, have that being construed as private money, even though it's reported on your forms and all that as a loan. I just didn't want it to be...
Well, I think council is right that it's... It would... If it's the candidate's loan, it's got to be deposited. You would transfer it from your personal account to the dedicated campaign account.
Okay. And at that point, it would be a contribution from you, a candidate, to your principal campaign.
A loan.
And therefore would be a contribution and not private monies. I think what this is aimed at is preventing candidates from just simply depositing personal money that they plan to spend on a trip or clothes or something unrelated to the campaign.
Okay,
it's only
so
money.
It's quite possible that some campaign accounts are the same as the candidate's personal banking account, and they're simply reporting campaign-related contributions and expenditures to their filing office.
Yeah. Okay. Correct. I'm done with Section 3.
Okay.
That was painful.
Boy, it was a long neck.
Why don't we move to Section 4?
Okay, Section 4 is a technical amendment, both 4 and 5 amend the statutes that relate to statements of organization that both candidates and general PACs must file. In each case, this bill amends both of those laws to require that you, as a candidate and general PAC, simply list on your statement of organization the location and the name of this dedicated account, so that that information is on record with the Secretary of State.
What's the point of that?
Mr. Chair, it would serve an enforcement purpose. I think, for one thing, it would, first of all, provide proof that you have, in fact, set up the account. It would also give the Secretary of State the tool to, you know where the account is in the case that they get a complaint or have to do some sort of enforcement activity relating to the account or to personal use or some other alleged violation of the election law.
That makes sense. Mr. Chair, I do have another question. Whoever wants to. just something just occurred to me. Oh, is this House Bill 3458 requiring that an account be open at all times? Reason I say that is sometimes you can have just such a measly amount in your account and you would just be getting these service charges that would put you way in the negative unless you close it out temporarily until the campaign season heated up again. I'm just wondering if that's requiring that.
Yeah,
I'm in that situation.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator, this bill does require that the account be in existence at all times. Yes. As long as you are in the system, if you cease becoming a candidate and get to the point where you have no balance and close out of the system, then you're done.
Just continue the committee, close the account, and then when you're ready to crank up again. That's assuming you had a 4-year term of office.
Can we amend that?
The board did not. Not campaign. But that we would read that the same way, that you'd have to discontinue the committee. If you had a de minimis balance, just stop, and when you're ready to go out and raise money again, open another account.
Okay. You can't just put it on hold. I mean, it just seems like a big.
You have to ask
paperwork.
Mr. Martinez that. The banks.
Back on Section 5, when I read the location, I read the community. And I'm assuming what you're meaning is the name of the bank or the name of the financial institution.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, yes, that's what I meant when I wrote that.
Sinclair.
Yeah, and could I add something to that, Mr. Chair? We appreciate it, since this seems to be a key section here for enforcement. Some things that would aid our enforcement is if there was actually a requirement that we get a bit more information about the account. We'd like the account number, the name of the holder of the account, the names of all who hold signature authority. And we also believe that you should make this information exempt from public record so that, it's submitted to us, but it's not public record. And we also think you should give thought to requiring it that these accounts be in Oregon for purposes of if we have to get the information.
Because
it said a financial institution in the state of Oregon in Section 3, I think it was, didn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
But I got a question about that. I agree with you, having that information is important, but sometimes I wonder, how available all of that information is to the public that you file with the Secretary of State, and I'd like you to look and see what information needs to be available, because sometimes they ask for your home address, the Secretary of State does on their forms, or the bank does, and then all of a sudden that information is public record as well, and home phone numbers, for example, is another one, and that happened to me where I have people calling me at home, and they got that information through the Secretary of State's office because of what you required to fill out on the form. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a Freedom of Information Act thing. I don't know. But I don't know if it's specifically related to this. But I think there should be some sort of, maybe not in this bill, but be cognizant of what information we're giving to the Secretary of State and what information the Secretary of State gives to the public.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, we need specific exemptions in order to hold information that's submitted to us privately. And we're happy to discuss those issues with you.
I have a little bit of heartburn over having my account number provided to the Secretary of State. I have no problem with you being able to request it or to even call for it if I was chosen as part of the audit or review, whatever term we go with. But in terms of disclosing it until you need it, I would have a problem with that. Unless there's a real case for it, and then I gotta share that with us.
Is there other information you collect currently from candidates that is exempt from public record?
I can't think of anything obvious right now. Well, we got a complaint in the last election cycle. We started putting, as you know, PDFs of campaign reports out there, and we've covered up the signatures of those reports that are put up on the internet, and we haven't gotten any complaints about that so far. Those signatures are available if somebody came and looked at the report. I mean, you're required to sign the report. You need to swear that the information on the report is accurate. We do take steps here and there to try and make sensible decisions about this, but there are some things that are just public information unless law says that it's not.
What would you gain by having the account number?
Just ease of enforcement if we have to enforce something.
How would you enforce it? I mean,
well, if we have someone that's uncooperative, then we have to go in and subpoena the bank records. It's, for example, and we've never had to do that. We've always had cooperative people, but if we should have to, it saves us some time and public expense to go try and find that information if we're trying to do an enforcement action against somebody that's not cooperative.
I suppose if you had somebody really uncooperative, they probably wouldn't give you the right number to begin with. Just a thought.
I have trepidation with it. If there's another way to get there, I mean, I understand what you're saying on that. I do. I'm just uncomfortable having a bank account number floating out there.
Okay.
Do you have a thought, if you or the Ethics Commission or somebody were in the process of some kind of investigation and you knew the institution and where it was, would the institution, if you went to the institution and you said, I want Friends of Dave Hunt account information, would they give it to you?
They'd probably want a subpoena from us.
And that would be, whether you had the account number or not, you'd still have to have the subpoena, you're saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you're probably right. I'd be hesitant to give you if you don't already have a process where you divide information between public record and not. It seems like we're safer just keeping everything in the public record. If there was some way that it better enabled you to do an audit, then I'd be all for it. I'm just not seeing, I'm with Representative Smith on this, I'm not seeing how that better enables you to do an audit or investigation.
We need specific statutory exemption, such as we now have for candidates' home addresses if they have a court order under the public records law. We occlude their home address from any candidate information that's available to the public. It's particularly useful for judges. And so we have a process of occluding or keeping information that's exempt from public record from public disclosure, by computer and through our internal office procedures.
Maybe I could ask the question in the reverse way. If you had the account number for every candidate, does that better enable you in any specific way to be able to do the regulatory enforcement or audit function?
It simply gives us a reference point with the bank. rather than in case the name, as long as we have the name of the account, and it is exactly as it is on the bank records, and there is no other account in that name, and we know which branch it's with and which bank, that probably the account number isn't necessary.
Yeah,
it does need to be in Oregon, though, so we can...
We had the Friends of Greg Smith or what have you, and it was that the Bank of Eastern Oregon, Heppner branch. Not that take long to find out which account it is.
But if it was Greg Smith in Portland?
It was the Friends of Greg Smith, and it was in the Gresham branch, and it had the right branch. Again, I don't think that's going to take...
I'm wondering about the names of signators. Sometimes you've got, would there be a penalty if for some reason you change treasurers or you know, some other signator authorization and didn't report it?
Well,
you know.
We require now that, and law does, statute, that when you change something that you now have on your statement of organization, you have to update within 10 days.
But currently we do not require the names of the signatories.
Correct. So it would be simply something you would update when you change treasurers.
And how does that help you? Well, I'm just...
Who's authorized? It ensures that the people that are on file with us are the people that get the right checks on that account. We don't have that assurance today. Unfortunately, it is complicating some investigations we're in now, for example.
Could you explain?
No.
What do you mean? No, not the detail of your investigations.
Oh. Because the statute says that the treasurer's the main person is responsible for this account, and yet you have somebody who is neither the treasurer nor listed as a director that's an authorized signatory on this account, writing, say, checks to their own campaigns as opposed to the PACs.
Yeah, I had a bookkeeper once who did that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
She's in jail now. Okay. Yeah.
But again, those names we think should be exempt from public records simply because we don't want bad people to use that information to access those accounts or funds. You know.
What if we did this? Today the Oregon Bankers Association are in the building. What if you folks got a hold of OBA and said, you know, the committee's a little bit nervous about having account information floating out there. We want to figure out how to expedite our process. What's the best way to do it? And then maybe come back and tell us.
We'd be glad to do that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the Credit Union Association as well.
Yep.
Some more. Yeah. Go with my account.
And I guess whatever you guys come back with, we'll take that. Read section 6, just because it's bold. Could you share with us what that means on page 4?
Mr. Chair, section 6 simply adds section 7 to chapter 260, the campaign finance chapter in ORS. And then section 7 is the statute that would require random reviews of C&E statements. It would apply to candidates for state office only. State office includes statewide officials, members of the legislature. It says that the random audit could require a look at not more than 4 contributions and expenditures on each statement. This statute here applies, it would apply from January 1st, 2006 until January 1st, 2007, at which point the electronic system would kick in. So this section applies to the current paper filing system that you use now, the current filing deadlines, reporting periods, etc. What it says, and basically it would only apply for 2006. The primary and general elections would require that the Secretary of State conduct these random audits 3 months after the primary and general elections.
Is that 3 months after the election or 3 months after the deadline for filing each statement?
3 months after the deadline for filing the statement. Yes.
Is the thought on this, one, we're assuming that we're going to do electronic. Two, we're assuming that there's going to be money behind it.
Mr. Chair.
The system. And then three, we're assuming it'll take about a year to put that together.
Right. If you read ahead in the bill, you'll see Section 8 looks remarkably similar. And it is basically Section 7 amended to address electronic filing. Section 8 then takes effect January 1st, 2007. So Section 7 works for a year, and then Section 8 kicks in to accommodate electronic filing. Same concept, there would be random reviews, but 8 covers the current paper system for a year. I'm sorry, 7 covers the paper system for a year. 8 covers electronic filing.
Because this is kicking in, the electronic would kick in January 1st, 2007. Is there any fiscal that's going to be required for 2006? Absorb that in internally?
We're reviewing all the fiscal aspects of this bill, and we'll hopefully have this by noon tomorrow. So if I could defer an answer on that until our analysis is done.
My one thought, committee, and again, I'm very open to wherever you guys want to go, is I want to do this right once. And having two systems, and one that's going to supplant the other, or one that's going to supplant an existing and then be supplanted again, troubles me. But that's, I'm open to where you guys want to go.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wanted to clarify. Apparently, Section 7 applies to random audits, but only up until electronic filing begins. Will there still be a vehicle in place for random audits after electronic filing begins, rather than just random reviews of what you see printed out, information given to you? It seems like what I'm picturing with your random audits anyway is that you would want backup and actual paper backup and documentation for the expenditures and, So I just wonder if that would still be in place after.
Representative Thatcher, that's what Section 8 would do, is adapt Section 7 to accommodate the electronic filing system. If you look at Section 8, it simply takes out the references to 260.058, for example, on line 8 there, and it substitutes a reference to Section 19 on line 12. Section 19 is the new electronic filing system. So basically, it would be a seamless transition as far as the Secretary of State's review authority here. The fact that the system changed from paper to electronic on January 1st wouldn't necessarily matter to them. They would still only get to review a maximum of 4 contributions or expenditures. They would still do it on a random basis. They would simply be doing it under an electronic system.
Mr. Chairman, this is one session we had comment on it. When our staff read the bill, they read this statement, the line about provide documentation of not more than 4 contributions and expenditures listed on each statement for each reporting period. They read that in 2 different ways, and it would be good, we think, to clarify that. Are we limited to asking for documentation on a total of 4 transactions, or is it 4 contributions and 4 expenditures? Follow me?
What was the intent?
The way it's written now, it's 4 transactions, because it says contributions and expenditures. If you want 4 contributions and 4 expenditures, then I think we need to specify that clearly.
With 4 transactions, really what you're trying to do is an honesty check.
Right.
Does that give you sufficient opportunity to do an honesty check?
Well, that's a good question. We've never done this before. I really think that's a policy call for you folks on whether you feel 4 is enough or 8's enough. I think the original, as I remember the discussions around the building about this, we talked about 4 checks. copies of four different checks, and the early discussions on this were always aimed at expenditures and not contributions. And so that's about as much light as I can shed on it at the moment.
Well, but, come on, you're the audit team here. Come on.
If you want to, well, yeah. We're not auditors on our side. that's across the street. They got a whole bunch of them. If you want to, you know, provide more public assurance, you know, probably four of each would give the public more assurance that we're doing adequate checks than just a total of four.
Are people that are going to lie about deposits?
I'm sorry?
Are there people that are going to lie about contributions? I can't see why. I mean, if I was going to have a criminal mind, I can't see why I'd want to enhance the amount of money that I now can't report or can't document that I spent somehow. Does that make sense?
Well, unless there was some sort of motivation to lie about the source.
Oh. Got it.
To underreport was actually what I was assuming.
Yeah.
They would be going after, not overreporting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't understand.
There are some committees that only have four contributions in a reporting period, like or for expenditures. On the other hand, a large committee, say a statewide candidate or a ballot measure committee, could have hundreds. Yeah. And just using two of each is somewhat of a crapshoot as to whether or not you're going to... If there is something untoward in that committee's books, just having two out of 1,000 transactions may not let you know that.
Well, why don't you go with a graduated, I don't know.
Why don't you just split the baby in rather than four and not eight? How about if you go with six? Split the baby and call it good.
Three.
I mean, this isn't a scientific approach. It's an honesty test.
Right.
Or say up to six. Depending on what the...
And actually, the language in here is not more than.
Yeah.
So,
there you go.
To some degree, you've got... I mean, maybe we should pick a high number, and then you all... I mean, for a statewide, I don't know why you'd want to treat a statewide campaign. I assume you'd want more than them.
That would be logical to us.
So maybe the number should be...
Yeah, percent.
Higher or percent.
Not more than, and then direct us to grade-aid it from...
About a percent.
By size.
Or percentage.
Percentage is more of a calculation that maybe you don't need to get into, I think, but you'd allow us to just set up a system to grade it up to no more than X number of transactions in a committee's reports. That makes sense to us. Even when we talked to the state audits division, they said you should prioritize larger committees over small ones. If there's something untoward...
Right.
It's big bucks, it's going to be in the larger committees, and so we don't really want to make these small make work for us to figure out four transactions for, you know, a DA candidate that's unopposed and make her file these. And so I think either Representative Hunt's approach of having a maximum and let us figure out a rational system of prioritizing the number of and which committees.
I think we do have a concern about how much paper we get back and what we're required to do with it. And so, you know.
Does eight work for you?
Sure.
Up to eight.
Again, I'm going to be...
Statewide? Is eight work? Ten? Or, I mean, because it's up to, and then you can figure out in rural or whatever you want to do, if you want to use a percentage or whatever, right?
Look at that day.
I still think that we come back to the original question. Do they mean now it will stay, say, eight instead of four, and it'll still, the question will be, well, does that mean eight or 16?
Okay.
We still need to clarify that they mean eight total transactions.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Right. And you get to pick whether it's four contributions or six contributions and two expenditures or whatever.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if you might ask. I'm kind of curious, you know, in our first subcommittee meeting, I asked about, you know, the random full-blown audit of committees, and that was discussed as, you know, in the hearing that we heard that, you know, some folks thought that really that was, you know, the only real way to make sure we had, you know, really a legitimate review
going on, and that these spot checks really doesn't lend to that. And I asked about perhaps the cost of what a full blown audit was, and where we could go with that potentially. I don't know if the chairs had any more discussions with the Secretary of State's office on that issue, or because I don't see that in this, unless it comes in here later. Has it just been left out? Or
I was going to actually raise that issue because there was a reference to these being random audits, and it's our understanding that these are not random audits. These are spot checks of expenditures and contributions.
And that's a discussion I'd like to have, whether we can have, in addition to having these spot checks, to go through our campaigns, whether we should have, random audits that, of course, the Secretary of State's office will be able to afford to do, which probably isn't a lot of them, but, should we, dedicate some funds to doing random audits of political committees, throughout the seasons.
You have the ability to audit today, though.
In a fashion, we have the ability to investigate, which is pretty close to auditing. And if our assumption, and I did talk to the chairman about this issue, and with respect to this bill, and our assumption is that if there's a problem that turns up in the spot checks, that would launch an investigation by us, which would require us to ask for the records and do some form of audit. If one thing leads to another, we can always ask for more records and sort of treat it in a methodical process where we expand the scope in order to get whatever information we need.
Do we need to change the language we're using then from random review, random audit, to random investigation? How do we use similar terminology throughout this entire process? Does it not matter?
I think we want to be careful about the wording used here and not lead people to believe that we're doing audits when we're really not.
Exactly.
If you want to do audits, we'll do audits. and we're happy to come up with whatever information you need to put that in the bill. But I would defer to our expert drafter over here over the correct terminology of what we're doing. I mean, we refer to them as spot checks. That's not great legal language, but
I need some clarification, too. You're saying that these weren't really random audits. I'm reading the word random maybe a couple different ways. Like, there's a pool of candidates, and one of you could be picked for a random audit. Or is it that you can all expect to have your account checked for random transactions? I mean, which is it?
Random review of statements.
That's the way we read this bill. It applies to candidates, committees only, not other kinds of PACs. And each one would be subject to us asking for a random selection of documentation after each report.
Okay, so they can all plan on that there's going to be eight transactions or up to eight transactions chosen to be reviewed.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, if that's incorrect.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that it seems to me that this language is subject to a couple of different interpretations, and so I think that you need to decide which way you want it. I think in some people's minds, this section means that the Secretary of State will select random candidates and then do it. So it would be a good thing to specify clearly in this section which one you want it to be. Do you want the Secretary of State to review a random selection of contribution and expenditures from each candidate, or to select random candidates
and then
do
random
that
transactions?
What I would share with you, and this is just one of four perspectives, I don't like having the cloud over us wondering which one's going to get it. And I'm of the opinion that if we're going to do transactions, that we say, line number 16, all of it turned in line number 16 kind of deal. And so it's all 90 members turn in line number 16. You don't isolate. And it takes away the who's next, because you know you're all next.
Mm-hmm. And you just don't know where it's going to land on your report.
That's
just
my
good idea.
Well, Representative Smith, we would appreciate that, because we don't relish the thought of suggestions that whoever we select, there's a political motivation behind it.
I see a lot of problems with, you know, bringing in the fifth grader to hold up the bucket of balls and pick out who it is. Unless you want to go alphabetical and start with the letter A. then I'm fine.
Number one, line one first.
Yeah.
No. I assume the four of us would be
first, so I'm just figured that way.
We're working on them right now.
I mean, to me, it seems like whether it's a random four or eight lines on a sheet or a random four or eight candidates out of the entire pool doesn't, to me, seem to be much of a difference. Although I guess I was hearing, when we had the public hearing 2 weeks ago, I was hearing from some of the folks who had been on that panel, at least I thought I heard, more of a sense that doing a random, more complete review of some was actually preferable from their standpoint to a kind of a spot check of everybody, but more of a thin layer of everybody was less complete and valuable than doing a deeper review of a few.
That's correct.
You all may not have a view one way or the other on that. Well, maybe you can reflect back, having worked with that group. Was I accurate in hearing that from members of that group?
Yeah, I think you were. Specifically, I remember Lynn Lundquist mentioning random audits. And that is what they're referring to, that there would be, we would somehow randomly select a number of candidates, and that candidate would be subject to an audit, however we choose to define audit. But generally that term means a complete review of financial records.
It seems to me that during your spot check process, you might have more questions, which might trigger a more complete audit, and that, to me, that seems logical.
That's what we are assuming as well, Representative Thatcher, that if there's some problem that comes up with the spot checks, that will prompt us to open an investigation and ask for the financial records, and let's clear up the problem.
Mm-hmm. Because this is for the record, it may be a situation where someone just misreported something and didn't do it in the right way, and it's a chance to clean it up.
It could be, yes.
And just make it right.
Yeah. With, by far, I would say 99% of the issues we deal with, it's people just simply making mistakes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is just a chance to keep it clean.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So I'd like, excuse me, I jumped in there. So I'm wondering, do we need something in this language or in this statute that clearly triggers the Secretary of State's office to go from this random spot check review, whatever we're going to call it, to the next step of an investigation and then to the next step of an audit? I mean, is that process something we need to identify in statute?
I think that depends on how much you want to leave to the discretion of the Secretary of State's office, or whether the legislature wants to prescribe that in statute. Our assumption is that it would lead us to an investigation in order to answer the questions.
You already have that ability, though.
We do.
Okay. I think what we're... And again, I'm not speaking for all four of us. My understanding is we're just putting a mechanism in place to help you kind of snare issues that will keep this process above board. That's my understanding. And then, you know, rather than you just, you know, having to deal with complaints as they come in, you've got a system in place that acts as that snare.
We do feel we have the authority now to seek records and get the information if we need it.
I guess, actually, one question and a comment. How many candidates does this apply to?
Well, we have about 600 committees that are active in any given election, and I think the number of candidates is usually around 350. But this would also apply to local committees.
Right.
And so, frankly, do you remember the numbers? We tried to figure it out. It really is quite remarkable how many local candidates there are. So since it's applied to local committees as well, it's, I think we're up way over 1,000.
How many thousand?
Over 1,000
in
any cycle.
Thousands. City candidates, but they're in four-year terms, so 500 up every 2 years. And 100, well, five times, it's 150 county candidates, again, 75 up every 2 years. And then the special districts, provided you allow for the $300 exemption, which I think this bill does, for candidates, most special district candidates are going to fall, will not even be committees and have to do any reports. But there are, what, 4,000 or 5,000, I think, special districts, not all of whom, you know, have elected officers who mount campaigns. It's hard for most special districts to find people to serve as directors, let alone have contested races.
But to be fair, a lot of these candidates that you're speaking of will not be going through the Secretary of State for this process, but perhaps through county elections, or do they all go through the Secretary of State?
Well, I think, if I might interject there, unless I'm missing something, Section 7 and 8 about the review says that it applies to the principal campaign committees of candidates for nomination or election to state office, which eliminates the local people. State office is defined as all of your statewide officials, members of the legislature, judges, or district attorneys. So that significantly reduces the number of candidates. It would not apply to independent PACs, just to candidates for state office. And secondly, under the current system, as well as electronic filing, all of those people file with the Secretary of State currently, and they would under electronic filing. So it is only the Secretary of State who would be doing these audits.
The follow-up comment, I guess I'm wondering, in terms of wanting to almost protect the Secretary of State's office, whoever the Secretary of State is, from just the appearance, well, the temptation to do something political, or the appearance of being over, of being political. I guess I'm challenged based on the testimony we got a couple weeks ago. If we did, actually random audits that in some way could be, you know, that we tell the Secretary of State you will do two, and one will be a Democrat and one will be a Republican or whatever. We're almost protecting the Secretary of State from either being political or being seen as being political. And so I guess I'm still struggling to see if there's some way to combine these two ideas of having the random spot check there's both kind of a cloud hanging over you. You have the potential stick out there that hopefully motivates good behavior. One clearly is outlined here would be a random review. But based on the feedback and reading the report from that interim group, I guess I'm still just struggling with, is there a way to also institute some kind of a structurally sound, non-political process that will motivate good behavior and protect the Secretary of State's office from being political or appearing political?
This is going to sound very elementary, and I apologize for that. I remember being in school as a third grader and having to be the only person in class to put my head down on my desk. That was pretty embarrassing.
First grade for me, yeah.
It was actually a freshman in college for me. But there's a big difference between that and having the whole class put its head down on the desk. And so that's... To me, I would rather say all 90. You have to provide your 8 different documents, and it takes the politics out of it again, because all 90 plus the state officials provide whatever is requested by the Secretary of State, and everyone submits those. And I got to tell you, I think you would trip up a lot more dishonesty having it across the board than you would just by trying to grab two every year.
What, Mr. Chair, though, if they looked at my eight things that I submitted and they said something looks suspicious there, they decide they're going to go ahead with the full investigation,
right?
At that point, I'm singled out for cause, probably like you and I were when we had to put our head down on the desk. And that, I guess in that case, it almost feels like it is more of a political... as opposed to saying four of us, which just happened to be the four members of this committee, are going to be audited. It has nothing to do with us. It's no pretense of any kind of a violation. It's just you're the four balls that came up, or you're the four members of this committee, so therefore you have to go first. I'm actually worried if we have the Secretary of State's office be the judge of those eight things, which one looks a little suspicious or not, and what's over the line or not, in terms of being meritorious to moving ahead to a full investigation, if we're not almost going to be created with a situation that looks more political. Because if it happens to be a Republican Secretary of State and I'm a Democrat and they choose me to go forward, it's not random at that point. They're saying it looks like there's cause.
And let's play through this a little bit. I'm assuming they're going to say, okay, we want contribution number three. Show us what it is. Show us the deposit slip. Right there, they've done one check. And if 89 out of the 90 say, here's deposit, here's a copy of the check that was deposited, here's the deposit slip, they're off. The one person who says, well, boy, I can't have it, that's going to trigger and let them say, we got a problem here, especially when it occurs on transaction number two and they once again say, can't do it. This is a much, I think the having it across the board is a much stiffer way to protect Oregonians than just randomly grabbing four. Especially if you statistically look at it. Four out of 90 versus 90 out of a 90, and you're doing it transactions. And then on the expenditure side, line 16, show us the receipt. He said, and every one of us would have a different explanation for line 16, but every one of us would be required to have this receipt documenting what we did.
Mr. Chair, but at what point would it... something in good faith was lost or misplaced. At what level would it trigger and be considered an egregious enough offense to trigger
that's
a full audit? Yeah, I know, but I would really want to get involved with that part.
I think, though, that here's my take. And again, I'm open. My take is, as was just stated a moment ago, 99% of the situations are just accidents, mistakes. And this is a chance to clean those up. If, eight items are called for and seven out of the eight are spotless and the eighth one is a mistake and you can, through sweating bullets, show, it was just a mistake. I seriously doubt they're going to call, Coopers and Libran up and bring in the CPAs. But on the other hand, if four out of the eight and you start saying, there's a good reason for this, but I can't share it with you, that's probably going to trigger something. I think there's got to be a little common sense involved in this. That's my day. I've had errors on my CNEs, and you call up and they say, here's what we didn't like, and you say, oops, let me send in an amended CNE, and you correct it and you send it in. Mm-hmm. They send you back a statement that says, they send you back something that says all's well.
Mr. Chairman, with any of our investigations, we try to ask all the questions that we think we need to ask in order to resolve the issue. We don't like to be, subjected to accusations that there's political motivation behind what we're asking, but on the other hand, if we don't ask the right questions and don't get the complete information, that can come back to haunt us as well. We'll be revealed to have done a bad job. So we're going to do what we need to do in each and every one of these cases to try and get the questions answered. And if it's an accident,
it's an accident, if it's simply a lost receipt, mm-hmm. you know. But, you know, that, we'll be able to figure that out.
What would you want to grade it? Say, if you've got, at first you're asking for eight total transactions. I don't know, it's just an idea. Eight total transactions and something's kind of amiss. Are they subject to maybe having eight more being looked at? And then, you know, say if there's a pattern developing here, you know, eight more and then eight more, and then after the third set of eight more and you see a pattern developing, then that would trigger a full audit maybe? I mean, it's just a wild idea.
That's been our discussion, is that we would gradually increase the scope of what we're looking at to see if, is there really a problem there?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this just something really minor? And we'll keep asking for more information until we get the questions answered. But we want to go about it as a gradual process, because we don't want to have to go to more work than is necessary, and we don't have to put the campaign to more work than what is necessary in order to answer a question.
Well, in all fairness to the Secretary of State, the last thing you want to do is turn this into a witch hunt and find out you're wrong, and next thing you know, it's backlashing on you. I mean, I've talked to my folks who do RCDs, and they tell me you folks are wonderful. You know, they don't always agree, get frustrated sometimes, but the fact is you can call up, you can say, you told me I made a mistake on this, how do I correct it? And a solution is given to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear, Mr. Chairman. We really do, first and foremost, consider ourselves an agency that assists people in complying with the law, not first and foremost an agency that fines people. I mean, fines are at the end of the process, way at the end of the process. The most important thing is to get timely and accurate disclosure.
What do you want to do, committee?
Well, I'm getting more comfortable with the idea, but I'd just like to hear that these types of spots reviews that, you know, really are going to identify problems and lead to, you know, the kind of audit that's going to bring back the trust of the people of Oregon that our campaigns are on the up and up as far as handling our finances. And, you know, because I was really, you know, from the earlier testimony thinking that, you know, random full audits is the only way to go. And I'm getting more comfortable with this, listening to you, if you think this system will provide us the what we need to definitely do a little checkup on our campaign finances and make sure, you know, we're according to Hoyle here. I'm turning to you because you're the experts that do this, you know, and I know, you know, I've had great experiences with the Secretary of State in making sure that I'm correct, albeit, you know, I've spent hours looking for 7 cents and really didn't feel that was a good use of my time, but I had to do it, you know, so.
Well, we think that 7 cents is important, Representative Holbrook. We're glad you worked for that 7 cents. We're fine with random audits if that's what people want to do. We're also fine with spot checks if that's what people want to do, where you have spot checks and marry it to our current system. It all depends on what you as policymakers feel that Oregon needs in order to have confidence in the system. We can do either one. What we can tell you is that random audits will probably be more expensive because it depends on how much. First of all, we have to define an audit. What is an audit? Is it something very basic or is it something very complete? And then depending on what the decision is there, we can put a cost to it. But our staff is not trained as auditors. I mean, we have auditors across the street in the audits division. And so we have a source we could look to for help or to do the audits if that's what people are interested in.
How would you handle it, though, if of the statewide, the governor is selected for a full-blown audit? Or the Secretary of State is selected for a full-blown audit? Who's going to do that?
Well, again, our staff is not trained as auditors, so we'd either have to hire auditors and bring them in-house, or we'd have to contract with an auditor, or we'd look to our audits division to do it for us, and
somehow I have to pay them to do it.
That's going to have a fiscal.
Yes.
What do you think the fiscal would be on the random? It's going to be less, I assume, or excuse me, the across the board is going to be less than doing a full-blown audit.
Probably, but we'll be able to give you that information tomorrow because we're really sort of scratching our heads on some of that stuff. This spot check involves a lot of paper coming in and a lot of checking. I mean, we got to go through and check all that stuff and then follow up if there's any issues. And so we do think it may well end up in the need to add a modest amount of staff, but we'll be able to tell you that for certain tomorrow.
You're an auditor.
No, I'm an attorney.
I have a financial background. Mm-hmm. I do commercial lending, and part of that, obviously, is background checks. And when I review a commercial loan and someone says, I have excellent credit, I pull their credit report, I glance, I look at two or three items on there, I ask for verification of it, and if I get documentation of what's on the credit report, it matches up, that serves as a sample survey for me that the rest is most likely accurate. If I ask for the information, ask for the documentation, and it's inaccurate, and the sample survey fails, and that tends to have me really dig into a credit report. And again, I'm not trying to oversimplify this, but to me that seems like a rational approach to determining, to creating an honesty test.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a sense on it.
And it sounds pretty parallel to how this bill is written, and our assumption of how it would work under this bill.
It's too, is, I mean, every quarter or whatever we come up with that a couple of your items are going to get pulled. That's really going to place something in the back of your mind that you better keep this thing straight.
So, Mr. Chair, are we as a committee going forward with every candidate subject to up to 8 transactions being chosen? Is that the direction we're
That's
needing?
My take.
Okay.
That's my purpose.
And then, I guess, do we want to deal with what to do if something's stinky in one of those, one of those reviews?
Well, see, and I think they already have that authority.
Okay.
Right.
I think we're just saying we're going to create the mechanism. We're going to create an honesty test for you.
Exactly.
And if someone fails it, then your authority kicks in and you do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
That's my understanding.
And I just have one. I think I agree with you there. I just have one quick question about, this is obviously going to be over and above what you already do and what you do. So there will be a fiscal impact of doing these 8 transactions of all these statewide candidates. So I would imagine that, albeit it'll probably be cheaper than doing random full-blown investigations or audits. So I think maybe this is a good path.
Mr. Chair, do we want to look at maybe putting a threshold? I mean, there's statewide candidates, but there's some statewide candidates that don't take in $500 or $10. I mean, my opponent didn't take any money.
Makes it pretty quick.
Yeah, right. But I'm just wondering if it does have a huge fiscal impact, if you put a threshold in there, if that would affect, just something to look at anyway, when you're looking at how much it costs.
Maybe we could defer that until after we figure out what we think the fiscal impact is, because I don't think it'll be huge. It'll be something, but I don't think it'll be huge.
And then,
eight's the maximum.
Is it the intent of the
fewer,
just for the record, it's the intent of the committee not necessarily to require 8,
mm-hmm.
but to allow up to 8 based upon the discretion of the Secretary of State, based upon the nature of is that
size of the committee?
Size of the committee, the amount of money going through it, mm-hmm. the number of transactions.
But it would be uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Within that framework of up to 8, picking by size, some objective criteria to apply to trigger 8.
But it's uniform all
8 versus 2.
To everyone.
All candidates for state office.
Yeah.
Another technical question. I'm wondering if we would somehow be limited to a random review, and that review only includes up to eight, and if we would not be able to then further investigate. You know, if it, somebody said sued and said, hey, look, you did more than one review, and it says right here you can shall conduct a random review. I don't know. Just wondering.
We're going to amend this language, I assume.
Pardon?
We're going to amend this language
yes.
based upon these thoughts, and then we'll review it again, and we'll make sure it reads just the way we want.
Okay.
Boy, did we get through with number seven now?
do we feel comfortable with seven?
Yeah, I think we've talked
through
it pretty well.
That's a sticky
one.
For Secretary of State's office, you vote. Section 8. How far do you want to go tonight? We've lost one of our members.
You've got to leave me 30 minutes.
With an excuse.
He has an excuse?
Yeah, well... Here's my the message I was given was to punch through this and get this done. I want to make sure we do this in a thoughtful manner. And I would feel most comfortable having Representative Hunt back with us. Mm-hmm. And I know I have other commitments, and I think the rest of us do. Would you folks be willing to come back?
Of course. Yes.
I'm going to Hepner tomorrow.
You're going to Hepner. I'll be there too. I'm going to Van. Do you think the chair of our committee would be okay with us coming back and continuing to work on this?
Mm.
I stand on the Fifth Amendment.
You stand on the Fifth Amendment.
We are scheduled for a public hearing work session for the 11th.
Mr. Chairman, if it helps, we don't have any other issues with the bill, so...
You don't?
We don't.
That did help.
Yeah.
I did like the staff.
Actually, yeah.
Really, Section 7 was it?
Yeah, that was the last one.
Oh, okay.
Up to there, yeah.
I hate to do this to the committee. I'm sorry. Representative Kitt directed me to work through this bill.
I know.
I'm a good soldier, and so I think we are going to. If anyone needs to leave, I understand that, and so long as I guess the key people stay, we'll just.
As long as you're left with a Democrat and a Republican, right?
I hate to do this to the committee, but when the chair gives me directions. It's important for me to follow the direction of the chair.
I think you're right.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a phone call.
Why don't we do that? Would it help everyone if
stand
we
at ease, yeah.
about a 20-minute? Is that okay? Why don't we stand at ease then for 20 minutes and come back? Let's keep working through this bill. And again, I apologize.
I'll get you home for it.
Thank you, please.
Trust me, I would like to to go as well. So we're going to stand at ease for 20 minutes.
Right.
me back from at ease.
Okay, we're back from at ease, and we're going to begin moving on to Section 8.
We're going to flip pages.
We're going to flip pages? How do you want to proceed forward? Why don't we, I guess, Section 8. What is Section 8?
Section 8, I think we've dealt with. That is just the review, audit/review statute adjusted for electronic filing. And anything that we do to Section 7 will do the same to Section 8, so that it will kick in for electronic filing. So I think we're ready to go on to Section 11.
Okay.
And that is on Item 3 of the joint press release. That's the statute that says that any PAC that files with the Secretary of State has to submit a copy of financial institution bank statements with their CNE filings. It applies only in the electronic filing system world. It would require that you file with any electronic statement that you file the most recent bank statement, and this would go back to your dedicated bank account statement under Section 3 of this bill. You don't have to file the same statement more than once. It allows Secretary of State to adopt rules to exempt certain personal confidential information. And with that caveat, allows the statement itself to be subject to review by the public in the same way that CNE statements are. Finally, in Section 12, this section takes effect on January 1st, 2008. So it won't kick in until the electronic filing system has been in operation for 1 year. It won't apply now to the current system at all under the bill. It would kick in after the electronic filing system is in effect for a year.
Why wait a year?
Mr. Chair, those were the drafting instructions, and I'm not certain that I'm able to answer that question.
Just to clarify, it just requires one per what? Per year, or?
It requires one statement every time under the electronic filing system. Every time you make a contribution or receive a contribution, make an expenditure, you'll have to file that electronically with the Secretary of State. You'll have to file your bank statement with that statement, but you only have to file the same statement one time.
The same actual month.
Yeah, the next time you get a statement and the next time you have to file, then you have to send in the next month's bank statement. So you're not going to have to send in the same statement over and over and over again every time you receive money or spend money. Just, you know, basically, so ultimately, you would have 12 bank statements. If you had activity throughout the year, you'd end up filing all of those bank statements with the Secretary of State's office.
I have a question. I assume that the three of you are also working. I know the Senate is also working on this electronic filing system. Is this going to be pretty close to what they're working on? I mean, in the end product, are we going to be able to, or is this drastically different than what the Senate is proposing? I'm just curious if you're working on the somewhat similar issues over there, that we're not going to be so far apart from their bill to our bill that, you know, we have problems coming up with something that works.
Mr. Chair, the way this, and Representative Fulvey, the way this bill is drafted, it contains a whole bunch of material in this press release that's not in either the Secretary of State's electronic filing bill in the Senate or other versions of the electronic filing bill. However, the electronic filing provisions of the Senate bill and this bill are virtually the same. So the second that either the Senate or the House starts to amend provisions of the electronic filing sections of the bills, then they might start to go apart. But right now, just the electronic filing parts of this will match up with what's going on in the Senate, at least in the printed versions of the bills.
What are you folks going to do with all these statements?
Well,
We'll obviously have to take out. Well, we'll file them with your you know, each campaign. Will have a file, and we'll put them in the file. To the extent that they may be useful, if we have some issues in that random matching spot checks, they may be helpful with that, helping resolve some issues. So we may look at them to assist us with that. Otherwise, we're viewing this as a document that we're to make available to the public.
Isn't it duplicating a document that's already available to the public? Because on your contribution expenditure report, you're already showing the checks that you've received, or actually the... How do we classify it? Make sure I'm correct on this. I guess the checks that we receive or the in-kind contributions that we receive, and we're also stating the expenditures we received. Hmm. Now all we're doing is we're showing it once again in a different form.
Yeah, my assumption, and again, this is not part of the electronic filing bill introducing the Senate, but my assumption is that this is a way for the public to verify that what you've reported, what a campaign has reported on the in the electronic filing system, matches what's in the bank records.
Wouldn't it be easier just when you do your quarterly? Is it an annual review? What do we call it? Your review? Just to say, you know, we want line 16, and part of line 16 means you're also submitting the bank statement to document that. And what are you going to do with these things every month coming in? It seems silly to be sending in monthly statements. To me, it seems when you make your random that part of that the document submission would be the verification with the bank statements. One, it's going to help you reduce the amount of paperwork you have coming in, and two, it's also going to help streamline your verification, because what's going to be submitted is going to be relating exactly to what you asked for, hopefully. If not, something's triggered. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Chairman, I think your scenario works. I think this is a scenario. I'm not. I can't speak to the motivation behind it, but my assumption was that there would be full bank statement verification of what's being reported earlier in the process through the electronic filing system. And you're required to do that stuff every 7 days, and then this bank statement will trail behind that.
My preference, committee, again, 104, is that part of the random review is if you need verification of a checking account balance, that would be one of your inquiries, and you'd say, please submit documentation from your checking account verifying deposit of XYZ check. I think that would reduce the amount of paperwork you're going to have in, and I think it'd become less burdensome for elected officials and for candidates to think that every month they've got to be sending in their bank statements. And again, I'm not sure what a bank statement does other than it's going to verify what's already reported in the C&E in a different form.
That's true, Mr. Chairman, and it's sometimes it could lead to some confusion because your bottom line number on your bank statement isn't always going to match,
and
because of timing.
You're exactly right, and that could cause a public misperception, and people who are with the best interest of the state of Oregon in mind may be watchdogging an issue and not completely understanding how that cycle works. I just throw that out there.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, your ending balance in your bank statement isn't going to match an ending balance for a reporting period. They're not the same dates. and checks may have not cleared or may have cleared a particular bank, and even though it's going to be on your CNEs. So there is really that lack of comparability as far as balances go, but I think the bank statements do offer reconciliation part to it that is probably helpful to the Secretary of State's office. It's just a question of, does the Secretary of State's office need it? You know, every month from every campaign, do they need those bank statements to enable them to do their job with the CNEs? I mean, I think that's really our question.
Yeah, and just really quick, back on the honesty test, you know, there's nothing that would prohibit in this you from saying, you know, in November, can you provide us with line 15 in documentation? And at that point, you'd provide the bank statement with, you know, whatever you need. And right there, you'd better be reconciling, or at least all 90 members plus the statewides better be reconciling, because you're going to be asked to show it.
That's our assumption of the kind of procedure we would use if those spot checks turned up a problem. We'd ask for documentation, including copies of the check and most likely a bank statement.
I just don't know what you're going to do with bank statements every month if all of a sudden you get those pouring in. You get 600 people out there during a campaign cycle. That's an awful lot of bank statements you're dealing with.
Well, we're used to dealing with big quantities of paper, and hopefully the electronic system will, you know, we won't have to deal with as much paper. So, again, I think this is probably an attempt to provide public assurance and an independent way of verifying that what a candidate is putting into the electronic system matches what's going on in the bank records.
Just one second, I'm going to go to representative. We're also going to have a fiscal tie to that, because someone's going to have to do the work to put that in there, and we're going to have to balance the cost versus the benefit, knowing that there's other ways of building that public confidence. I just throw that out there.
I agree with you, Mr. Chair. But I want to, because when we were going through this earlier piece, we weren't talking about, you know, when you're doing this spot check, we're talking about giving you a copy of a check and a copy of a contribute or deposit, and not necessarily a bank statement to go along that verifies that. And I think that that would be a good thing for verifying that process, I guess, to enable that bank statement. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, that bank statement helps you reconcile when and where that deposit and contribution happened. Is that a useful thing for the Secretary of State's office in this process, or is it not?
Well, I think in terms of, I think where we would start with the random spot checks is, for donations, if we selected donations, we'd ask for copies of the check front and back. And for expenditures, we'd ask for copies of the check that went out.
An invoice.
And an invoice. And then if there's any issues with that, maybe ask for a bank statement. But I think we'd probably ask for a bank statement in stage two if we're having trouble with the documentation that was provided by the campaign.
Did I hear you say that you wanted copies of the checks front and back for contributions?
Yeah.
And how would we be in possession of anything that would be pertinent on the back of a check for contributions given to us from others?
Yeah, it would just be for the expenditures.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm thinking out loud here. I'm sorry. For contributions, the front. For expenditures, we'd need the back to
back
for the cancellation.
The back of the contribution would show when it was deposited and confirmed.
Right.
Because under Section 11, as we understand a bank account statement, that is just total deposits per day. You know, so you're just getting a total deposit, not the component checks that make up that deposit. And you're getting by check number the payment out.
a disbursement from the account. You're not getting who the payee is or who the contributors are. And so that's why we'd want copies both of the contributors' checks and...
Well, I could see the front of the contributors' check, but I just don't see what would be pertinent about the back of it.
It would only become relevant if it were...
How would we have any position?
About when it was deposited.
Go back there.
If there was some mismatch between the reports, dates of when things were received, and the bank statement that we...
So what you're speaking of is that actual stamp that the bank stamps on the back of the
right.
check of when it was deposited, which I think Representative Thatcher is saying, a lot of banks don't provide you with those canceled checks.
But the canceled check would go back to the contributor, not the...
Right. And that's where... That would be step three, is going to that pack or... that individual.
But that information you could find through a bank statement of that deposit date with that amount.
Right.
And so, as long as you have the ability to, when you're doing these spot reviews or further investigation based on that spot review, that you're able to request or demand, I guess, the copy of the bank statements that have that particular deposit or check on it.
I'm thinking out loud here, Representative Hovey, but if what people want in these spot checks is for us to get a copy of the checks, we could require campaigns before they deposit checks to make a copy. Some jurisdictions do that. So before you deposit your donations, you make a copy of the checks and keep those in your file.
Right.
Another smart thing to do.
We used to do that, yeah. And it used to be required to submit them. But it was a lot of paper.
and I do keep copies of those.
Yeah,
in
most campaigns do.
So we could ask for the
contact
copy.
Information in some cases.
But if we specify, and maybe that would be helpful to include in the bill, the candidates should make copies of their contributions before.
Become available for...
Right.
Okay, maybe under the part where we're talking about the review, mention that the items that could be subject to review, such as the deposit slips and or bank statements and or copies of checks, front and back of canceled checks, or...
Yes.
Well, there's another statute that talks about the Secretary of State setting up the system of accounts and what records need to be maintained. To have a legislative...
Okay,
indication that we need to expand on that, it would be useful to put it there of simply what records a committee should generate and retain so that we know that they're available.
Right. I'm with the Representative Thatcher. I still don't understand why we need the copy of a back of a check.
Not of the contributor's checks, no.
So, can we bring the chair up to date on what we've decided to do?
I apologize.
We finished what we're on.
We're out of here. All right.
Well, we were just talking about copies of checks specifically and what the Secretary of State's office would prefer or what we should use as campaigns is maintaining copies of the contributors' checks that we deposit.
Isn't that just
common sense?
It used to be required, but it's no longer required by us. But I think for purposes of these spot checks, if we're expected to ask people for documentation, we're going to need to have them give us copies of their copies.
Copies of the check, because if they just deposit it and don't make a copy of it,
the actual checks will be gone and back in the hands of the contributor or their bank.
So we need to specify that that's a requirement to have a copy of it.
Let's think about the 90 members. Is there an issue with the 90 members in that exercise?
Not that I know of.
I think you're probably correct, Ms. Representative Smith, in that they're probably all doing it anyway.
They don't have access to a copy machine directly. Usually the bank has one. I don't think that's too much of a hardship.
Yeah, to me it seems like a good common practice to maintain.
Right. That's why I said I'd do it.
Well, nonprofits do it these days, too.
And just very quickly, I guess just for comfort of 90 members, if someone lost that check, I'm assuming they could make a note in there and say the steps they're taking to acquire the check. And once again, common sense is going to be used. If it's the Oregon Restaurant Association, you can say, you know, I'm in the process of getting that.
Well, that pack would have the canceled check.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a process to get it.
Right.
But if all of a sudden you find right. four of these checks,
so
saying, council common sense goes out.
Council and I were saying that we're looking at ORS 260.200, where we the Secretary of State shall prescribe a uniform system for accounts and then prescribe forms for statements and other information required under the section to be filed. We might want to expand on that to say what kind of records to generate as well, and that would be then your indication that that is an expectation of all political committees, that they maintain copies of contributions and...
I mean, how about bank statements, receipts...
And canceled checks. Receipts.
Checks.
Deposit slips.
Yeah. So rather than just... furnish a system of accounts and records... required by or well, by this chapter.
Mm-hmm. That could say well? Something like Secretary of State could adopt rules, may or shall adopt rules specifying material that can be may or shall keep or retain
committees. Be all subject to review, yeah. And you have to maintain them.
And your receipts.
How long would you have to retain all this?
Well, now the statute says 2 years after the last time you filed the report.
Yes.
So if you discontinued today, you'd keep your records current through for another 24 months.
Let me ask a question.
We keep them 6 years.
If tomorrow I resigned, closed out my account, would I be obligated to continue reporting to you for another 2 years?
No, only if you had some balance left. If you discontinued, you're done.
You're done.
But you need to keep your records for two years.
Okay, but a candidate who ran and was unsuccessful, they close out their account, do whatever they have to do, like
they
normally would, and they're done.
Yeah.
And then they're required to keep them for 2 years. We're required to keep them for six.
What do you do?
The reports, not the committee's financial records.
Why the discrepancy on that?
For public access.
And we just ship them down to archives after so long, and they're kept down there, and then we destroy them once the 6 years is up.
Again, this is just for my own edification. You keep them for 6 years for public record. If I can destroy my records in 2 years, what's the point of you keeping them for the additional 4?
Because what you've reported to us is... what you've reported to us and the public. In fact, we published a summary book of for each election of all contributions over a certain amount and expenditures over a certain amount, and those are forever. But we keep the reports to back up the summary book for 6 years after an election. But we have a 2-year statute of limitations on going after you for screwing up on your report.
So it makes sense to you guys for some reason?
Yeah, you need to keep your records, which we otherwise haven't looked at. We just take your report and tell you whether it balances and whether you filled in all the lines as required by the form. And to the public and to the Secretary of State, that reflects the reality of your records because you've signed an oath at the bottom of the report. But for 2 years, if there's a complaint, we need to be able to go back and inspect your records.
But the 4 years difference, that makes sense to you guys for some reason to keep it.
Well, I'm not sure where the extra 4 years came from.
Keep it for two, you keep them for six.
I think there's freedom or information requirements for...
Is there?
That are, I think, is actually federal law, but I'm not positive about that.
Six or period?
That applies to
not 6 years.
Generally, when we talk about retention schedules, the archivist weighs in and the researchers weigh in. And
right.
It doesn't have anything to do with enforcement.
Yeah, I repeat, I apologize for asking.
getting back to the record of, you know, checks, the record of deposits, and, you know, the bank statements. Do we define how we keep a copy of cash contributions? As you know, you go to an event and, you know, people put a $20 bill inside of a envelope. They write out their name, their address, their occupation, and, you know, that ends up getting deposited along with, you know, in miscellaneous deposits, I believe. And, you know, I mean, I've gone to the pain of making a copy of the actual bill and the
a lot of people do
and the little form that they filled out identifying themselves and their occupation, blah blah blah. I mean, I know I'm probably pretty anal about that, but is that something that needs to be done? I guess I'm asking a question here. How do we give you proof of these cash contributions?
Well, that's a common practice. I've seen it in a lot of campaigns, and they come in to ask us to help them figure out why their books aren't bouncing. They have copies of the $20 bill with the interest form. We say by rule you shouldn't really take anonymous contributions because you don't know when that person's giving you three $20 bills and suddenly you have to report the detail of who they are by name and where they live and what their occupation is. A lot of committees do that. So I've seen central committees with raffle tickets, which is a common way to do it, but because that's, you're not getting a chance to win, you know, bonds. Bust of Abraham Lincoln is not necessarily a thing of value. The bust, of course, is, but the chance to win it isn't. And so it's a contribution, and so it can't be anonymous, and so you write down the name of the person on the side of the raffle ticket that you keep, and then those go into the committee records, and they can tell when that central committee's gotten more than $50 from, you know, Mary Todd.
I guess my point was, do we need to talk about, you know, providing evidence of cash contributions in this particular bill, or is that addressed somewhere else?
I think you just need to beef up, if you will, with the Emerald phrase here, that statute about the accounts to also include records.
Okay.
The phrase is kick it up or not.
Okay, thank you.
What did we decide on the financial institution account statements?
I mean, as far as the number?
The bank statements. How often do we have to submit those?
I think we're just talking about having to keep a record of them as they are subject to review by them.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that's where we're at.
Because if you go back to 19, it talks about that you need to... shall adopt an electronic filing system, etc. And I just, again, I want to make sure, from my perspective, we're not doing monthly bank statements in, but rather knowing that at any point in time.
We could be asked to provide them.
We could be asked to provide them, and the check that matches up to that statement along with what matches up on the C&E, if that's what line number is.
And that was my understanding, too, that we were not going to go for the monthly bank statements as part of this, but that the bank statements would possibly be asked for to verify the spot check of the contribution.
Okay.
You know, to see so that they can reconcile it with a bank statement as part. It's not just a copy of a deposit slip and a copy of the check. They may ask for the bank statement to verify that goes into the account along with that spot report.
You guys are good with that?
Yes. We're fine. Just a technical issue here, and it goes to the public records thing, is that our understanding is that then council would eliminate Section 11 and 12. which is the operative date, 3 years out. But again, I'm not sure what we wouldn't want to have some way of any piece of paper that's filed with a public agency is a public record unless there's an exception. And we actually have to make copies of them unless there's an exception, such as a voter registration card. And one reason our understanding is that that prohibition is written into the law is so that nobody can copy the signature, have a copy of the signature on the voter registration card. And for the same reason, we would think it prudent to exclude the account statement's going to have the account number on it and other information that probably is not appropriate for a public. The public could inspect the fiscal part of it, but the anything that would say allow somebody unscrupulous to.
Can't we just have the account blacked shall out. Be blacked out?
You just say account numbers, and we can come up with something that's narrow, but protects against identity theft and other financial theft.
But if what we're going to is, again, I'm thinking aloud. If what we're going to is a system where the bank statement is only submitted if we determine that we need it, why does that? I mean, that's we'd be doing it under the guise of some kind of investigation. Why does that need to be public at all?
Well, it's public. It is public unless it's a ongoing criminal investigation, and even a criminal investigation, once it's closed, everything in that file is public record.
So, I think what we want to do is, do we want to define what records need to be kept by a committee for 24 months, and then add in an exemption that if you do require copies of certain information, that personal and confidential information, you know, is exempt from public review?
Yes.
Okay.
So then, based on that statement, are we assuming a receipt?
Yeah.
Bank statement, deposit slip, and contribution.
And copies of checks.
Yeah. I'm not. Do you want to specify that statutorily, or just allow us to set that by rule? I mean, it'd be the same thing, but I'm thinking that
I need to define contribution.
Right.
I mean, unless someone gives you a box full of balloons.
It's complicated.
Or a box full of, yard stakes. As a credit union, as a freshman, give me yard stakes.
In kind.
That's a thing of value.
In kind donation.
In kind.
We're not going back.
Yeah.
But I need to have us define contribution because I think need to give latitude to you.
The legislature already has defined contribution, which is rather convoluted, which is why we have the other thing called other receipts, which are for money that you have to report in order to balance because they don't meet the legal definition, statutory definition of contribution. So that's why I'm suggesting that you try not to get into the specific detail of it because something might get missed.
Right.
And that's why you delegate that to the administrative agency for flexibility and we'll be prudent and you'll get a chance to review the rules before they're done.
Only if they're triggered. You'll have to see the amendments on that.
I don't feel comfortable defining those again because I think you do need latitude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't either. I was trying to get clear, you know, what we needed to know or what we needed to tell the Secretary of State and legal counsel so they're comfortable moving on to the next item. And I think we've got our ducks in a row here as far as the financial statements when we need to provide them, and there needs to be something written in that says, the confidential information as far as bank accounts or addresses can be blacked out or not accessible to the public. And we just move on because I think we've covered it, haven't we? As far as what we need.
Yeah. As far as here, yes, I have a pretty clear idea of what to write.
Okay.
And so I will take a stab at it, and we can look at it the next meeting.
Thank you. Why don't we go to page 6?
I was real comfortable with it, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, page 6.
Section 14, it amends ORS 260-083. That's one of the main statutes in the campaign finance law. It specifies what has to be contained on the contribution and expenditure statements that you file. This particular version of that statute applies beginning January 1st, 2006 until January 1st, 2007. So it's a transition until you get to electronic filing in 2007. All it does is change what you have to report for expenditures. Right now, when you make an expenditure, you have to report the name, the amount, and the purpose. This adds a requirement that you also report the business name of the person to whom you made an expenditure, the city that they're located in, if they're not in the city, the county that they're located in, and the state that they're located in. That's all that's happening in Section 14.
My question would be, just, I can't personally think of any situations where I'd be writing a check to somebody other than a business, but I guess it could be possible. Do you want to limit it to just business name or just name of payee?
Representative Thatcher, under existing law, it says name of payee. I mean, that's what the existing law already covers. Apparently, there must be a desire to have a business name instead of perhaps just a personal name of somebody who represents a business. I'm not certain what is driving this particular change.
I assume this is just for further disclosure.
How is that further disclosure if you have somebody that's not a business that you're writing a check to?
I could be an employee.
Maybe I can sort of shed some light on this, and it goes back to a specific case, but the situation was it was unclear where a check had been written to, and the name of the business was not correctly listed. So I think my guess is the attempt here is to make sure that a campaign is accurately listing the name. And if they get the name wrong, there would be an address there so that we could further check on it and try to narrow it down who they're talking about.
Okay.
That's the address part.
That's true.
Says was Representative Thatcher's question about line 14 specifically, but the name or, if applicable, the business name?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we know what's behind that.
Well, it does say if applicable, so I guess if it isn't a business, never mind.
No.
Drop that one.
We would want.
In a receipt, I mean, if you have receipts, other than,
they don't
need
to
know. You get receipts that are just cash registers, you know, and they tear them off, and or the little tag at the bottom.
I think the attempt here is to just get more complete information about to whom and where expenditures are going.
Currently, don't we have to list that information on our CNEs? I mean, under current law, don't we list the name and address of the expenditure?
Just the name. And the amount.
That's lines 12 and 13 in italics is the existing statute, is existing requirement. Name and purpose. Name of the payee and the amount and purpose.
Okay.
We explain B, the name or, if applicable, the business name of the payee of each expenditure, the city or county, if the payee is not located in a city and state in which the payee is located.
In state.
I don't understand that.
Mr. Chair, what the instructions were to require the name of the city in which the payee is located, and if the payee doesn't live in the city, then you have to list the county. That's what that sentence is trying to say. You have to list the city.
You're saying in Morrow County, if I live out in the country.
Correct.
Okay.
You have to say Morrow County, State of Oregon.
Even though your mailing address is Boardman, Oregon. If you weren't in Boardman, the way we read this, it would say, you wouldn't say Boardman, Oregon, even though that's how somebody might.
Does this make sense to somebody? I mean, I'm not trying to be on.
I kind of had the question myself of why.
Why don't you just ask for the address?
The address, yeah, but maybe
complete address.
Yeah, like you do for a contributor.
complete mailing address.
Yeah.
The dilemma I have with that
physical
is,
address.
Again, what happens if you're
don't know it,
or you're stopping at the C&D drive-in picking up a burger and a shake?
Good place too. It sounds really good right now.
Yeah, it just
yeah.
I mean, to me, that seems awfully
off.
Let me ask council if everybody in rural Morrow County still their address is Lexington, Oregon, Heppner, Oregon, Boardman, Oregon.
That's pretty good, knowing Lexington and Morrow County.
I love the place.
if you just said
by city and state, is it really closing and making it? Is somebody going to avoid that by saying, well, they're not in a city?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, the only reason that it's drafted this way is to account for anybody who lives within any sort of political subdivision in this state.
Okay.
Clearly.
I'll examine
any state.
You have a receipt.
Any state.
Right.
Yeah. You have a receipt, but it doesn't necessarily marry up with a name to your report.
Are you trying to identify?
You write it in.
Identify if this name or business is real, basically, and by adding city or county, somebody could investigate whether that name or name or business really exists.
The allegation is phantom expenditures.
Yeah.
Okay, and you don't want to have to burden somebody with having to know the address of the C&E drive. Full burgers are good. Boardman.
Boardman?
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
You're right.
I was Nils.
Nils in and out.
There you go.
So that
should
be nervous too.
What do we want to do?
I mean, I understand why you're putting it there for the phantom expenditure.
What?
I don't know if there's an easier way to word it, really, that you should identify the city or county, blah, 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 that the expenditure is made to, and state, because sometimes your expenditures may be out of state.
Well,
I don't know. Oh, it'd have to be which state. Yeah, state to state.
Well, are you going to verify McDonald's? I get a McDonald's receipt.
Well, if you actually give McDonald's a campaign check, then you'd have to do that. But if you're, I mean, I think you've already...
Oh, is this just checks?
It's just expenditures.
Yeah. If you're getting reimbursed for those petty cash expenditures, the check would be to you.
And then what do I do?
And then it would be coded as to...
But they would have
the purpose.
They would have to list the payee of each of the expenditures for which they're getting reimbursed and the city that they're located in.
McDonald's and Heppner.
McDonald's, Heppner.
I'm sorry, I've been doing ways and means all day. What makes the most sense to make sure that the check is going to the business it's supposed to go to? Isn't that what we're trying to get at here?
Well, that's my assumption, is that they're trying to provide information so that it would be easier to find the places where this money is going. So, I mean, I think a mailing address works. The name and the mailing address.
Yeah. But that would be pretty.
Yeah, I think the address by city and state, which I've seen in other state statutes, is sufficient. But I don't think that should. I was looking up at line 6, which is the contribution detail, and it simply says address, and we defined that. I think, isn't that true? No, that's in 005.
No, subsection 9. Address has the meaning given at home and rules it up by the Secretary of State.
Right. So we've done right, and so I think we want to distinguish between the address of a contributor, which we need the mailing address for, and the address of a payee, which all we need is the city and the state for. And so if the committee agrees with that, council can draft that.
On the surface, it seems pretty, innocuous.
It's silly to me. But if it makes sense,
less detail than we require for contribution. But
I can, only because
that doesn't mean
just it gives them another tool to verify whether a place is real if they really wanted to investigate.
So I'm not writing a check to Mickey Mouse in Eugene, Oregon. They could actually find Mickey Mouse in Eugene, Oregon.
If he's there.
Okay.
If he's there.
but help me with this just really quick, and then I'll move on. I should have a receipt that would document Mickey Mouse, and
you don't have a receipt, but you might not have a name on it.
Yes,
please.
Just a clarification for staff. I'm looking at the PC2 and the PC3, and what I noticed there is that on the PC2, which is contributors, it does ask for name and address of contributor, whereas on the PC3, for payees, it does not ask for an address.
Right.
So this would then add that element to the report that you're going to name an address in this report, whereas now you're not required.
But we wouldn't require the
address.
The address.
Just ask for city and state of payee, which you don't have currently
state,
reported.
City and state.
City, county, and state.
Let me throw this out. And again, what if we just said the county?
Would that be helpful? Would that do it?
No,
I think if you just said the city, because everybody knows, by a mailing address what city they are ascribed to, whether they're in the incorporated limits or not, because every mailing address is by a city in a state. But we don't need the zip code. We don't need the mailing address.
Right.
Not everybody knows what county they live in, let alone where the McDonald's that they stopped on in I-84
city or county
is. And I just know people, trying to find occupational information is hard enough, but I'm trying to figure out what county Ione is in Spray.
Well, I'm thinking about driving around to, Portland area, and you've got a lot of different cities right around there. You've got Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and Oregon City, and Jennings Lodge, and all that. And I'm just wondering, you wouldn't necessarily know what city you're driving in necessarily when you're driving around. So, say you're in Clackamas County, would that still suffice? That's why I'm wondering if going with city or county would still give you enough information.
The person might not know what county you're in Portland.
What if you said any expenditure over $50?
Well, that's another way of approaching it.
I guess you pass
the McDonald's issue, and then you get into the real campaign expenditure.
You okay with that?
I like it.
As long as it's only asking for more detail for expenditures over a certain amount, that's the same amount as for the more detail for contributions, and the $50 is there.
So, is that it?
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay, for expenditures over $50, we are requiring what? City and county? Just city?
City or county if there's not a...
Same language except we're just applying the $50 threshold.
County if the payee is not located in a city.
If the payee is not known to be located in a city, you don't necessarily... I just don't want that to be a technicality somebody gets hung up on.
But you still want the name and amount and purpose for all expenditures regardless of the size, and then for $50 you want the address.
See, and I guess, again, I'm not worried about that. You bring up Lexington. Lexington's not a city, it's a town. I believe you guys aren't going to send out the...
It has
the
a post office,
team.
Doesn't it?
Evidently, he's been there.
But, I just don't see the SWAT team showing up because it says...
No.
Morrow County is... Lexington, when Lexington...
It's more information than we have now.
We just need
city, town, or county.
We just need some more information in order to find this business.
Got it.
If it's there. And if it's in Lexington, we'll find it.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. That's right.
So we settle on city or county if pay's not located in a city, or are we just going to go with city or county for each expenditure over $50?
I thought that they wanted the city or county if the pay is not located in the city, because that helps you in larger count in larger areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we're leaving.
Well, you threw town in there, city, town, or county.
So we're leaving B, but making A to well.
I think it works.
I like it.
I'll figure that out.
Let's do it. For him to get details.
So can we move to page 7?
Yes.
You can, please.
Okay.
Section 16 is the ban on candidate self-compensation, as it's described in the press release. What it does is say that a candidate may not pay himself or herself from candidate funds for services that the candidate has rendered to the candidate's own campaign.
Can we go back to line 14 really quick on 7? On page 7. This section does not require a vendor.
Line 14.
Foreman style.
I'm sorry, 14.
Right.
That's foreman style.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, just an effort that we're trying to translate the law into English. So basically, Section 16 says that if you are a candidate you render legal services, you're an attorney, you render legal services to your own campaign, you cannot then pay yourself from your campaign account for legal services rendered to your campaign.
Yeah, I've got a question here, too, on this one. Sorry. I know you want to get with
me. No.
I have a signing company. It's a company, however, owned by different people. I happen to be one of the owners. I made myself sign. You know, I had the company make signs for my campaign. Would that be considered as a non-reimbursable expense now? I mean, it goes through a few... I don't know. It kind of goes through a different entity. It is a company. I'm just wondering, because I am a part owner of this company, if that would be construed as self-reimbursement.
Can I add to this real quick?
Yeah.
Professional services could be bookkeeping services.
Mm-hmm.
And so you couldn't use your campaign money to hire a bookkeeper?
No.
It says pay yourself to do your own books.
Right.
You can't pay yourself to be your own bookkeeper.
You can't pay yourself for secretarial services that you provide to your campaign.
Are people paying themselves to do their own books?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Are people paying themselves to do their own books?
People are writing checks to their professional corporation for, usually it's management.
I have my own business. So there's people who would take their campaign money and write a check from their campaign money to their own personal company.
For services.
Mm-hmm.
For professional services.
Well, they say management, usually. In some cases, it's rent, and that's pretty clear.
Some cases, secretarial.
Secretarial services.
Well, they...
Go ahead.
I just need time to think through this.
Yeah.
They're paying themselves out of their campaign funds for a service that they're providing to their campaign.
So it's just a way of paying yourself out of your campaign.
Some people may look at it that way.
Right. We, by rule, say under the statute that prohibits personal use of candidate campaign committee monies, that a candidate may pay herself a salary or otherwise compensate themselves for lost time. And we're not convinced under current law that, and by that rule, that paying your personal corporation, your PC, for the use of the facilities, the use of other employees in that firm's in that firm for the services they provide, such as they may be answering the campaign phone.
And they could be out campaigning for you too.
That's right, on their time, but
corporation.
And the salary is being paid by the corporation, so the committee's not, and so they're paying this entity. Which could be a law firm that the person's a partner of or an accounting firm.
So what you're saying is that if the campaign is going to hire services like that, they should pay it directly and not...
Well, this is all Section 16, as we read it, says, is that the candidate committee may not pay the candidate for the rendering of professional services by the candidate.
What's the principal campaign committee mean?
That's a candidate committee as opposed to a PAC or a... central committee.
Well, what I hear you saying is that I can't reimburse myself for my time for campaigning, knocking on doors, but I might be able to pay for the employees who are being paid through the end.
Right, because
okay.
They're providing the service, not you.
Got it.
Can you say that one more time?
Well, I understand it. Or if you get in a little vehicle and you go out campaigning, you're one of those people, but you cannot reimburse for your time away from work doing this, but you can reimburse for those other people who are being paid through that company.
Yeah.
For their time spent campaigning.
Section 16 says you can't pay yourself out of your campaign money.
For professional services. So to go back to Representative Thatcher's...
But some clear that this doesn't refer to any other person, just yourself.
Yeah. Okay. No members of the media family, no employees of the...
You can still hire your kid, your cousin.
Yeah, your spouse.
Your spouse.
Okay. Really?
Right. Then back to Representative Thatcher's initial question about the sign company. Those are signs or signs stakes. Those aren't professional services. Those are goods,
mm-hmm.
and they would be covered by this section either.
Okay.
Section 17.
Section 17.
I just want to get back on 16 real quick. To me, that seems like common sense. Am I miss? Okay.
That's
Section
common
17.
Sense. Let's move on.
A person who holds public office may not.
Mr. Chair, this section. Let me adjust my pay. This is the quote unquote double dipping. Excuse me, section. And basically all it says is that you can't use campaign funds to reimburse yourself being the candidate. A candidate may not use campaign funds to reimburse himself or herself for an expense for which they have already been specifically reimbursed. In other words, if you will get a mileage expense paid you by the Legislative Assembly during the interim to come to Salem, you may not then also reimburse yourself for that same mileage from your campaign fund.
Let me ask this question. What happens if someone drives from Eastern Oregon, attends a legislative hearing, and also attends a campaign event? How do you separate out the two?
Well, Mr. Chair, under the current law, you would receive a per diem during the interim for coming to Salem for that meeting. You would have to do some pretty careful accounting, I guess, to make sure that you weren't using campaign funds to pay for some expense that you were using your per diem to pay for.
But it doesn't work. I'm not sure it works the other way around, though, Ted, that they would be proscribed from, since they'd already come to Salem from Coquille or wherever, that they couldn't also attend a fundraising event.
Sure. I mean,
at
the same time. You could attend the event. The question is only, could you then use campaign funds to reimburse yourself for any expenses of that trip?
Only if it costs you more than $91 to do that would be the threshold,
then
I guess, right?
Reimbursed for it. I mean, this makes sense as well, because if you're being reimbursed $91 from the state for legislative business, you shouldn't be being reimbursed or paying yourself for those same expenses from your campaign, which is essentially what this says. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, if Representative Thatcher has expenses of $180 and she does campaigning in this same trip, she should be able to...
Never combine the two.
But theoretically, she's reimbursed for $91 if she can document $180 of expenses. She should be able to use campaigning for the funds for the additional $89. Or whatever.
If they were indeed campaign expenses.
Correct.
Or public householder expenses.
Right.
In excess of what was reimbursed.
Mm-hmm. So I stay at the Marriott, and it's $120. Get reimbursed, what is it, 90 or?
91.
$91. I could write a check for the 30 or whatever the math is, for the difference out of the campaign account.
Right. You read it that way? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, the one of the important things about this is that basically it's a statutory codification of the existing Secretary of State administrative rule on this matter, which flows from 260.407, which is the statute that prohibits personal use. If you look in the campaign finance manual on pages 35 and 36, you'll find very similar language. What this is doing is moving that into the statute in very similar form. So the bottom line is it's not a dramatic shift in the law. It's already the law, but it's an administrative rule. This moves it into the statute.
How is this, with all due respect to my colleagues here, how is this affect fair, to rural Oregon? In terms of if you live in Salem and you get a per diem, do you get to deduct a portion of your mortgage? I'm trying to figure out.
My understanding is
we use our per diem for the actual expenses, where if you live in Salem and you get a per diem,
you pay taxes on it. That's right. That's the only the equalizer that the IRS and the legislature, in its wisdom, in the statutes about reimbursement of costs and how it sets the per diem, they used to have a differential, is my understanding, and then for people that did not live in the Salem-Kaiser area, got a greater per diem, and then I don't know how many sessions ago that was leveled out. But the consequence is that if you get the per diem and you live in Kaiser, you pay taxes on it because it's not for actual expenditures. True of even a private employer.
Sure.
And per diem.
I have no problem with this. I think we're creating. Is there another way to word this? I mean, I understand the double dipping concept. I don't want to create unnecessary traps either.
Yeah. Well, this language is based on the administrative rule. One of the effects of it, though, that you should understand is that it's not going to apply to per diem that you received during the session.
Right.
Because that per diem is given to you no matter what. It's not given to you for any particular purpose.
A specific expense.
During the interim, when you have to come to Salem from Heppner, you are given a per diem specifically because you are making the trip to Salem and you are given a mileage expense. So that is a case where you have been specifically reimbursed for official business. And that's what this says, is when that happens during the interim, you can't turn around and pay yourself twice from your campaign funds, even though you were on official business.
Let me give a scenario. Just help me work through this so I can understand it. I'm Betsy Johnson. I wake up in the morning. I have an empty tank of gas. I use my campaign account to fill up my car. And I drive here. Betsy Johnson, bad example. Tom Butler. drive here, spend the night, drive back. I receive $91. How do I show you that my campaign? How do I account for that? How do I show that I received the $91 and then anything else I spent, I use my campaign on?
I think you would have to reimburse your campaign account the price of gas, because you got paid for that gas or however much gas you used.
Yes, and that's what subsection 2 of section 17 says, is that if you make a payment, an expenditure, out of your campaign fund and you are later specifically reimbursed for that expense, the gas mileage would be a good example, then you have to take that per diem reimbursement and put it back into your campaign account.
Because the mileage allowance is covering covers the cost of gas, insurance.
Yeah. Yeah, the mileage.
Amortization.
So basically what we're saying is you can't profit off of your day's activity.
From your campaign fund.
From your campaign
fund.
Right.
In instances where you have been specifically reimbursed.
Right. Now, is the per diem specifically for gas, or does it cover lodging?
During the interim, there is a specific payment for mileage in addition to the per diem that you get for coming to Salem to an official committee hearing, for example.
Mm.
So there's two things there.
So are you saying, Ted, then, for our clarification, that in the interim, there's the mileage reimbursement, that's a specific expense, but then the per diem covers all other expenses incurred by the legislator for that trip? Is that you're saying that's a specific expense per se itself, the per diem, in addition to the mileage reimbursement?
I believe that was the intent, yes.
Okay.
If it doesn't say that clearly enough.
All right, we'll take it.
We should fix it.
Okay.
Then we couldn't do that.
If that's the committee's, then if that's the intent, we'll look at it in that regard.
And it seems to me that if you come from Heppner and you receive a $91 per diem during the interim, you buy a room downtown at the Marriott and you spend $60, it seems to me that you've been specifically reimbursed by that per diem payment for those costs incurred in the conduct of your official business. Under this, it seems that it would be illegal for you then to go back and reimburse yourself for the cost of that room also from your campaign fund. That's how I would interpret this.
Okay. But however, if in fact your per diem is for lodging and food, and your Marriott was $60 and your food was $40, you just spent $100 and your per diem is $91, your campaign could reimburse you $9. Is that
Mr. Cherrington told me, I think that's correct.
The receipts. As long as you can, yeah, verify all this stuff, I'm sure.
Just a clarification for me as I write my notes. Any reimbursement doing it per diem, are we sort of philosophically following the IRS in the sense that you got a per diem, and whatever it costs you, if you spend up to per diem, you don't gain expense, but if you spend more than per diem, you can now have additional expense. If you spend less per diem, you got income.
Yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, in IRS code, if you get flat per diem and you spend less, you got income.
Right.
If you spend more, you got an expense.
Right.
And it's a matter of who's going to pay for the expense.
And if you pay for it, it's a business, then it's a business-related, employment-related, it's a deductible expense.
Hmm.
Better do my taxes.
Are we good with 18 or 17?
I have no problem with it. I just don't know. I'm trying to think of the effect of it in terms of reporting and making sure that all 90 members can
figure this out.
Is currently the law.
And
under the administrative rule.
Right.
Yes.
And we've explained it in letters to the Secretary of the Senate and the Clerk of the House in previous sessions, so they've distributed this information.
So then why wouldn't we just have something in there referencing existing stat?
Well, this is simply rephrasing it statutorily, codifying.
It's in rule.
The rule.
It's in rule, not in
rule.
Statute.
It's not in statute. The only thing that's really happening here is we're moving the rule to the statute.
And the reasoning for that is?
The only reasoning that I understand is that this press release says ban double compensation for any expense.
Okay, that does it. And we can't change the rule once it's in the statute.
The Secretary of State would not be allowed to make the rule
unbanning. A case in point is Section 16 that we just talked about in professional services. We say by rule that campaign committees can't pay the candidate a salary.
the FEC, when that was identical to the FEC rules, Federal Elections Commission, until they broadened it two or three years ago to say the candidates could pay themselves a salary. We chose, as a decision of the Secretary of State, that we didn't think that was appropriate, that this is a state law, not a federal law, and we don't have to follow the FEC's interpretation of federal law, that candidates could not pay themselves a salary, and so we say that by rule. Section 16 somewhat restates that, but says it statutorily, so that we couldn't loosen it. No, same fine. With 17.
I'm fine with
okay.
that. And again, maybe it's late in the evening. I just wonder if there's a simpler way to state it.
Well,
and again, I couldn't do it. I understand the concept. To me, it's just confusing.
The simpler way is to take it out and rely on the rule and give the Secretary of State the discretion to, as Fred just described, modify the rule as they feel appropriate.
I don't want to weaken it. I just... Again, I don't understand it.
Okay.
I'm a big surprise. Okay. Section 18.
Okay, Section 19 really begins the continuous electronic reporting, and that's pretty much what's happening in the rest of the bill. These sections, pretty much from 19 to the end, are very similar to all the other electronic reporting bills that are out there. Section 19 is the meat of it, and just to quickly summarize what it does, it requires all candidates and PACs to file with the Secretary of State, and this eliminates local county filing officers for candidates. It eliminates city filing officers for candidates. All candidates and PACs file electronic statements with the Secretary of State. You have to file within 7 days of receiving a contribution or making an expenditure. The Secretary of State is then directed to make all the campaign finance information available on the Internet according to a schedule adopted by the Secretary of State by rule. It repeals all the paper filings and all of the reporting periods that currently exist in the election laws. It does retain some paper filing for campaign finance purposes for people like chief petitioners on state initiative petitions, for people who are making independent expenditures who aren't PACs, who aren't candidates. They would still file their stuff under the existing law, but the Secretary of State is directed under Section 19 to then put all that information onto the Internet so that people could pretty much view all the campaign finance activity in the state on the Internet.
I need to ask you to go back. So you get a citizen from a remote part of the state who perhaps doesn't have Internet. How do they file? Doesn't have a computer?
This would only apply to candidates and PACs. So it would only apply to candidates and to political committees.
Okay,
they're the only ones.
What would you do with someone who lives in Paradise, Oregon, that has no power?
Mr. Chairman,
he's a registered voter and a good citizen of the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, the Finance Disclosure Panel, this is related to the recommendations of the Finance Disclosure Panel, and they did discuss that subject, and the group felt that, you know, there is computer availability at public libraries statewide, and felt comfortable requiring this of all candidates. In fact, actually, the feeling was is that this is going to make it easier for candidates, frankly, than the paper system, and it was going to help them avoid mistakes, and you know that out the balance of them having to go to the library to do it, you know, the advantages of it outweighed the issue of having to go to a library.
No, I mean I get this. I like this.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm struggling with though is. Being candid, these are constituents of mine,
yes,
who very likely would want to file for a run for the United States Senate. And
well, then they're going to file with federal, but then they're going to file with the Secretary of the Senate, U.S. Senate, not with.
Well, let me step back. I want to run for governor.
Okay.
and may be very sincere, and well, but may not have the technological capability, let alone the basic infrastructure to meet with.
I think
how do we handle
that? I think the reality of those kind of candidates is that they'll probably fall under the threshold for
$300
for detailed reporting anyway.
You really don't see this as an issue?
It is an issue if they go over $300. Because under the electronic filing scheme, there's no certificate of limited contribution and expenditure, which is the $2,000 threshold for detailed reports. So that would be gone. So it's really $300, but these candidates rarely do anything other than pay the filing fee.
What happened? I'm not trying to, but please understand this is a cultural issue.
Right.
During the interim, I worked as executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen, and I literally had members who received their mail once every 2 weeks, who didn't have telephone, didn't have internet, didn't have power, came to town, once every 2 weeks, and these are veterans, registered to vote, citizens in good standing.
And are they going to solicit and receive and spend more than $300 on a political campaign?
Well, no. The question is what do you do if they decide to do it?
Then they need to come into town once a week, because the report, and go to the library, clean off their boots.
But I got to tell you, though,
and walk in and ask the nice lady to log him on to the Secretary of State's website. That would be it. But you're right. It would require a weekly trip into town.
I don't know how you would write an exemption for people like that.
I don't either.
Without it affecting a whole bunch of other people that you don't really want to bring into an exemption from electronic filing. The goal behind this is to get as much information to the public as possible, as quickly as possible. And the minute you open the door to exemptions, you start eroding that your ability to meet that goal.
How do you avoid the discrimination, though?
I mean,
you've got a glitch there.
I understand your frustration. People have the same argument, though, about filing voters' pamphlet fees.
I do.
That some people can't afford it, and only people with money can get in the voters' pamphlet. We run into these situations in other areas.
Where's that Health America Run for Office Act?
Health America Run for
Office. I like the concept. I'm personally fine with it. Again, for 99.9% of the population, there's no problem. But at the same time, I have a problem discriminating against the 0.01.
And just... It kind of reminds me of this bill that we had to repeal a statute saying it was okay to solicit on the highway with your little cardboard signs. People were getting windfalls suing the state when they were given tickets by policemen for doing so, and then they would holler that, hey, my constitutional rights are being infringed. And I don't want that to happen here. People purposely seeking little things in the law out that they can take advantage of. Maybe something to think about.
And Section 19 is applying to candidate committees and all political committees. Is that correct?
State and local.
Is this model going to fit, everybody? I mean, notwithstanding his question, but I'm sort of wondering. I'm trying to think, because so far we've been talking about candidate committees, pretty much, and now we're talking about the much larger spectrum of all political committees. So I'm just kind of curious if...
I'm not sure what you're asking about when you state that will this model fit. Are you talking about the electronic filing system itself?
Yeah, the electronic filing system, the 7-day time limits, maybe it does. I don't know. I'm just having a hard time moving from candidate committees to now all political committees on this same system.
Including school board people and all that? Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. I have to share with you now. Once you raise that, as soon as this became all, there's got to be an exemption process in here. Culturally, it's too discriminatory against people who don't have the capability to do this. I mean, I can tell you a very, very talented port commissioner who has no capability to do this. What do we do?
Well, I think, I mean, we instituted electronic filing currently, and there's a threshold of, you know, once you get to that $50,000 in financial activity, you go to electronic filing. This is a departure from that, in that it covers everybody, no matter what your level of financial activity is. If you allow exemptions, then you get into the situation where under electronic reporting it's every 7 days. Then do they have to file on paper every 7 days if there's a paper version of that? Or if on paper less than that?
I just don't
Well, it opens a whole lot of other questions when you start giving exemptions.
I can see that.
Well, I also see in this that you're going to be filing every day, theoretically.
If you have a transaction, yes. Or you could file once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you would be, as long as you had that day's activities as well as the previous six, then you're current within 7 days.
Right.
I suppose you could. As long as you got activity that week.
Right.
But, I mean, that. You know, if I was saying
later than 7 days, I see what you're saying.
Right.
So you could just do it once a week and still comply.
So if you're a small campaign that has no activity, there's nothing to report.
What I would like to do is have some research done on what other states have done with this situation, because obviously we're not the only state to have the issue that's before us, and so I think we need to find out what the options are. If I thought we were dealing with folks who, I know there's good folks out there who do serve on school boards, who do serve on irrigation districts, who do serve on port commissions, who.
The irrigation districts are exempt from campaign finance reporting. They don't even report to the Secretary of the Irrigation District, but they don't. They're not even candidates on an
election.
Soil and
Water Conservation District.
Soil and Water Conservation Districts, yes, we got them.
What are you going to do with them in Alhier County, in Harney County, in Lake County, in Wallowa County, in Baker County?
They go over $300. Now they do have to file reports. What they have to do now is by the first pre-election deadline, file a certificate of limited expenditure if they're not going to go over $2,000. That used to be $500 until six years ago, when the legislature raised it to $2,000. So I don't think there's any question, but what there aren't a lot of local candidates that are not used to filing detailed reports. This system is intended to make it very easy for them because it allows them to take their transactions, however small, and enter them in, and it's basically going to maintain a ledger for them.
I got to tell you, if you remember the debate here 6 years ago on pesticide use reporting, one of the biggest arguments was, I don't even have a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Now what do I do? It's a reality that this body's going to have to deal with, that the entire state isn't technologically on the same page. And somehow we're going to have to deal with that. And unfortunately, you're dealing with one of the four members who, those are his constituents, and I've got to figure out how to represent those folks.
And I'm not sure all political committees are up to this either, but, you know, certainly all statewide candidates maybe are, but... So, I mean,
can we just put a question mark next to this?
Section 19.
Before we leave the subject, I want to remind people that the system will be configured so that it makes it easier for people to file. That's the whole idea behind it. It's supposed to be easier than paper filing. So,
I agree.
And helping people avoid mistakes.
I'll be the first one.
We're not necessarily helping those small campaigns by keeping them on a paper filing system.
I'm concerned. What do you do if they don't even have a computer?
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, it's a reality. And so somehow we're going to have to deal with, find the compromise that can work. And maybe this is the compromise. I don't know. Let's find out what other states have done. And, maybe this is the compromise. So I'm going to move on to Section 20.
Mr. Chair, by and large, most of the other sections in this bill are technical amendments to make the electronic filing system work. Obviously, the existing election laws are set up for paper filings total. The rest of this adjusts other sections in Chapter 260 to make electronic filing work. So in Section 20, again, it's 260.083, the one that we spent some time on earlier, which is the statute that specifies what has to be reported. We have to amend it again to accommodate electronic filing, and this Section 20 would become operative at the same time all the other electronic stuff becomes operative, which is January 1st, 2007. So the only changes that are made are to accommodate electronic filing and a calendar year system instead of reporting on reporting periods as in the paper system. And what that means for Section 20 is if we amended the earlier version of 260.083 in this bill in Section 14, the same amendments would have to be made to this section. So it's in the bill twice, once to apply to the paper system, once to apply to the electronic system.
Can I get clarification on Section 26?
Oh, she's really jumping ahead.
Sorry.
What about 22?
No, that was assumed it on 26. Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
Of course.
That part? Okay. It says not later. Okay, I'm just trying to figure out what they're talking about exactly here.
Yeah, we're not sure either because we've never seen this. This is kind of an oddball report that we actually have never seen in our staff in the 15 years that the longest tenured staff member has been there. This is a corporate paid-in capital report. It wouldn't be filed electronically, but because these statutes are repealed about campaign finance reports for the primary and the general, that you've got to come up with some date for those to be filed.
Okay.
And so it's in the calendar year in which they pay in the capital to make the contribution or the expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of giving a calendar basis to this statute that we're not quite sure what it means.
Well, then if you don't know what it means, how would anybody else out there know what they mean?
I remember what it
means.
Do you, Tim?
What happened was a smart attorney figured out that he could set up a corporation and have people donate money to the corporation, and then the corporation made the political contribution to the candidate. The candidate's CNE form indicated a contribution received from the corporation, and nobody could ever find out who in reality gave the money to the corporation. It was a way to hide where the money was really coming from. So this statute was enacted to say that if you're going to do that, then you have to report who's actually giving money to the corporation. Now, it may be that, at that time they should have been
a pack,
but apparently there was something going on in the law that prohibited that, so that's why this statute was enacted.
And you don't have a freedom of speech issue there? I'm a corporation. I'm a legal entity. And if I choose to write a check.
Corporations are subject to public regulation, and one could be who bought shares. especially in a campaign disclosure. I mean, that gets...
But if I'm...
You say that about all campaign finance reporting, but today, that's not the ruling of any appellate court.
What it says is if the primary purpose of the corporation is to support or oppose any candidate measure. I mean, it's not like your accounting business.
And that's exactly what was happening here. The only reason this was set up was to make an end run on the contribution and expenditure reporting laws.
Corporate shell.
Well, let me ask this question really quick. I've received a contribution request letter from an individual that is incorporated. Campaign to reelect XYZ, and on it, it stated it was a corporation, and I wish I would have kept it.
But they still, if it's an Oregon candidate, and in fact in nearly every state, they'd have to file campaign finance reports. Federal candidate has to file.
What's
with
the benefit of incorporating?
Limiting liability, principally.
Okay.
Wish you got us to page 15, didn't you?
Yeah.
Come on, pick up the pace here.
I'd still like to know what page 11 does.
What does
page 11
do?
If you go over on page 10, line 43, it's the definition of filing officer. And under the current law, the filing officers can be the Secretary of State, County Clerk, the city filing officer, you know, for districts, for cities, for counties, for the state. They're different. If you're a county candidate, you file with the county clerk. If you're a city candidate, you file with the city. Under electronic reporting, everybody files with the Secretary of State. So this, on page 11, we're adjusting that to say two things. Number one, all candidates and PACs file with the Secretary of State, period. Number two, what that leaves out there are chief petitioners for state and local initiative and referendum campaigns. Those people file under a separate statute, which is 26118, under current law.
And recall.
This wouldn't change the rules for them at all. They would continue, chief petitioners, to file with the local jurisdictions if they're city, county, district. They file with the Secretary of State if it's a state initiative petition. That system would continue, and the way it works is if they qualify for the ballot, their petition becomes a measure, therefore kicking them into the state campaign finance system. To support a measure, you have to be a political committee. Suddenly, boom, they're into the electronic filing system, and off they go.
Tricky.
If I'm running for city council, where do I, and I'm going to have a political action committee, where do I currently set that up with this? With you
city.
Folks?
With the city. You file your candidacy with the city, and you file your statement of organization with the city recorder.
And under this system, it's not going to come to
you. You'll file your candidacy with the city,
uh-huh.
So they can put you on the ballot.
Right.
But you would file your political principal campaign committee with the Secretary of State.
Or cities going to be, and counties, are they going to be losing revenue?
There's no revenue. They're going to be relieved of staff time to receive and review and retain those campaign finance reports.
Again, I've never run for city council. Is there a fee you pay to run for city
council? There is for candidacy, usually, yes.
Okay. The cities aren't going to lose that fee.
No. No, this is only... ORS Chapter 260 is for campaign finance reporting, and the definition of filing officer is just for campaign finance reporting, where you file your C&E reports. 249 for candidates is the same, and 221 for city council candidates, 203 for county commissioner candidates, etc. Those statutes, all the special district statutes, will still have the filing officer with either the city or the county or the irrigation district. and the fees will go to those jurisdictions.
Mr. Chair, sections 24 through 38
are all
23 is not important.
Oh, I'm sorry. 23 is important. 23 is very important. That's the statute that says that if you're a candidate, then you're not going to spend over $300. You don't have to file a statement of organization under current law. What this amendment in Section 23 says is also you do not have to get into the electronic filing system.
Let me ask this question to the Secretary of State. If we moved that from 300 to 1,000 and then went, forgot about my issue, is that a compromise we could live with?
That's a policy issue.
All the little races, they're not going to spend more than a grand.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that you might want to fold into that is our experience where say if I'm thinking of in school district in Clackamas County where the candidate thought they were being very careful about staying with under the $2,000 limit, and only got lawn signs for a certain amount, only took in in-kind contributions from the local paper for ads of X amount, had figured out everything but their filing fee, and their filing fee put them $20 to $2,020 because the filing fee was $20. And that wasn't until after the election the complaint got filed timely, and we had to ask, okay, how much did you spend? And he had it all itemized, but he hadn't put it in any kind of format to file with the Clackamas County Elections Office. And so not only did he get fined for late reports because he should have, when he went over $2,000, filed detailed reports, but he had to try and figure out how to do that because he hadn't been doing it all along. So it does raise an issue for us of any threshold that then you say, as soon as you go to that threshold, bam, you got to be filing reports. Well, you sure as heck already kind of have some idea what's going to be required of you because then you're under the gun and you've got the public opprobrium of having violated election law. Worst case scenario, the election hasn't occurred yet, and that's going to affect whether people vote for you or not. And we've had some of those situations. They're rare. Certainly a threshold exists in most jurisdictions, and now it's $2,000 per paper filing. But if you, $1,000 is lower than that, so you're going to get people that are not filing paper detailed reports now.
I'm just thinking, you know, my sticking point on that is I want to make sure all folks in my area have a chance to run. And chances are the people who are going to be serious, this isn't an issue. $1,000 allows them to run whatever they're going to run and stay under that threshold. And I mean, if you're going to spend more than $1,000, you're a serious candidate, I'd assume. At least in my area, $1,000 is
Mr.
a serious
Chairman,
candidate.
We might suggest that we have the $2,000 limit currently for reporting on paper. That's missing from this bill. If you just make it apply to electronic filing as well, I think it meets your...
2,000 instead of 1,000.
Yeah, I was going to ask the same thing.
Yeah.
Why is this 300 instead of 2,000?
Okay,
300 was something new. When they went from 500 to $2,000 for the requirement, one legislator said, you know, we got a lot of special district folks out there that they don't have an opponent. They don't spend anything. Why even make them file a statement of organization? All that $300 floor does, or the first ceiling, I guess, the ceiling to the first floor. It's getting late, isn't it? Is that they're not even on the radar screen. Between 300 and 2,000, that's just for candidates who are serving as their own treasurers. Now, for all committees, if you're over $300, if you're packed zero to $1 to 2,000, you're on the radar screen, but you're just a blip. If you're a candidate over $300 to $2,000, you're a blip on the screen, but you're not a detailed you know, outline of the guided missile or whatever.
Can we go with that? Mm-hmm. 2,000?
Yeah, if you move the $2,000 in there, I think it solves your problem and it's no change really.
But would that be for section 19 and for all committees, John? Is that what you're...
Is that section 23 referring to?
Yes, line 35.
Line 35?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Moving that candidate accepts. So you don't even file a statement of organization?
No. The statement of organization stays the same at $300, right?
Okay.
But the electronic filing, which is your situation, I don't have a computer.
Right.
That threshold of $2,000 for paper filing would be moved into the electronic filing system as well.
I think that's very generous. I'm good. If you guys are okay.
Where's that change?
That would be in section 19. Yeah.
Do you want them to have to file?
Section 19, page 7?
Just like under 26112?
Yeah. So we still want them to file some kind of certificate with us. That's why they're not reporting with us, is that they don't expect to go over $2,000, and the statute would still apply that once you go over that, bam, you're in, and
no
you've got
it. No one could ever make an argument to me that they were kept out of an election.
Okay, good.
To me, that takes away all arguments.
And that's $2,000 aggregate.
Yeah.
Expenditures and contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Aggregate.
Whichever is greater, $2,000 in contributions, $2,000.
I thought it was currently aggregate. Oh, okay.
No, it's one or the other.
One or the other, whichever is greater.
What page are you making that change on?
Hopefully you're not going to spend more than you take in.
Well, we'll have to make that change to section 19. I think we might be able to simply restore 260.112, which is repealed by this bill, and modify it to apply to electronic reporting. It's the one that now exempts people from the paper filing system if they're not going to spend over $2,000. So we'll just fix that, put it back in here. And then in section 19, we'll say, except as provided in 260.112, everybody files.
And a point of clarification is that we'd like to keep everything on a calendar year basis, have that threshold be for a calendar year as opposed to an election.
Got it.
So you can't, you'd have to file reports if you had, even if you had a contestant, if you had to spend money in the primary and in the general, by December 31 of that election year and you're over $2,000, you've got to file detailed back to January 1 or whenever you filed your fantasy.
Calendar year.
Because that's how we'll read it. That's how Ted will write it, and that's how we'll read it.
So we're at $2,000 a year and not $2,000 on the campaign?
Right.
Is that the way it is currently?
No.
Currently it's $2,000 on a campaign.
Yeah, pre-second, pre-post for the primary, first, pre-second, pre-post for the general.
But if what your concern is about local candidates, they're not doing more than one campaign a year anyway.
Only two cities have primary elections, Eugene and, well, maybe Corvallis, three. Corvallis, I think, and Eugene and Portland. The rest of them, all council candidates and mayoral candidates are only on in the general. Special district elections don't have primaries. It's only the county offices and state offices.
This really simplifies it.
Yes.
I agree. Why don't we move on? I'm on page 14.
I was on 15.
So we didn't change it. So we didn't change anything in section 23 then on that $300 issue.
Right.
That still stays.
That's a statement of organization.
That's a statement of organization. Okay, now I'm clear as mud and we're moving on.
Mr. Chair, the rest of these changes basically shift from a paper reporting system with first pre, second pre reports to a calendar year and the 7-day reporting requirement. You know, we can go through each one if you like. The most important one to me of the remaining sections is section 39 on page 22. Which is the section that tells the Secretary of State that they have to maintain all this electronically filed data on the Internet for 6 years.
How can we finish? What does the public want to look at somebody's record back in 1999 for?
Well, for people that follow these things, they may want to look at a particular contributor and their pattern of contributions over a period of time.
Okay, there's a reason. Makes sense. That's. I can't imagine you getting on there. All right. You guys okay with that?
I have to apologize. I want to go back to 17.
Go back to 17.
What is Section 31 about? Explain to me quickly what Section 31 is
now. Oh, again, something we rarely ever get.
Okay.
There you
okay.
go.
Okay, never mind.
It's one of those obscure paying down debt of, and we've never seen it.
Good enough.
All right.
Yeah.
Never seen it. Mr. Chair, finally, the last sections on 23, 24, and 25. There'll be a quiz on that later. this is all highly technical stuff. All it does is set up the operative dates. It specifies what it's telling us is that the electronic system is going to go into effect on January 1st, 2007. It specifies some of these other sections that we talked about in the first part of the bill are going to go into effect immediately. Some of them are going to apply just for the next year until the transition to electronic filing. It gives the Secretary of State the authority to begin working now on the electronic filing system, even though the system won't become operative until January 1st, 2007. So it gives them legal authority.
Outweighs and means approval.
Well, it may be that this bill needs to go to Ways and Means.
Okay. Sorry, it's late in the evening. Sorry.
And I mean, yeah, in case they may ask for you or whatever.
Apologize.
And it just handles some of the transition details from paper to electronic. I'd be happy to answer questions about anything in particular if you want to talk about it.
I have still two. One, where's the cash go from penalties?
General fund.
It does go to the general
yes.
fund.
Pays for teachers.
Good. Now, new scheme of revenue.
we've thought that it should go into a special fund for the voters pamphlet. We've thought about that, but.
You're not going to open that up right now, are you?
No, we aren't.
No.
We have a separate voters pamphlet bill.
I don't know. I'm prepared to battle that one.
The second question I have, and I'll follow the committee where they want to go on this. One thing I'm still struggling with is for 1 year-ish having a new modified paper system and then moving to an electronic system. And I know there's going to be a fiscal on that. You're going to have to create new materials. You're going to have to create a whole ton of stuff. And I'm wondering if it makes more sense financially and to avoid confusion, just to say effective when the new electronic system comes on. Because you're going to have new forms.
We revise the forms every 2 years after legislative changes anyway. The only issue is to, if they require new information that the legislature has asked for and somebody uses an old form, we've got to then ask them for it. But I don't think that's really not a problem. We have to revise the manuals, the forms. We also actually have a housekeeping bill in that the full Rules Committee, House Elections and Rules Committee, has heard that it has quite a few provisions in it that simplify those forms, get rid of redundant or extraneous information that we would anticipate the House Rules Committee favorably looking at. And so don't lose sight of those in order to make filing simpler. We view House Bill 3458 as a disclosure bill and the electronic filing bill. I don't know, the only interim thing that might have some, even the statement of organization talking about the bank account, that's not an extra piece of paper or anything. We might have to reprogram Oracle. Spot checks, that's right.
But that will be modest, we think.
And that's Jane.
We'll be able to tell you.
Yeah.
What do you anticipate happening to the FTE that traditionally have been used?
Well,
this system wants
we're having that discussion now because continuous filing, we have to review a report within 10 business days, and anytime somebody then, if it's once a week or daily, hits submit on their entries, then that's a statement. But our hope is that once we get to electronic filing, it's going to have all sorts of help drop-down menus and the like to help people figure out that they haven't filled in a line completely, that the contribution is more than $50, and now they need to have the address and the occupation of the contributor, all of that ahead of time. And then also when they hit so they're getting help and getting their transactions in, and then when they hit submit, they'll also get a report saying what ain't particularly sufficient there. So we think that'll be our immediate notification to the campaign that
we're going to have reporting more often. We're still going to need people, our current FTEs, we think, to review the more frequent reporting. I think the nature of their job will change. I don't think we'll need more people unless there's some sort of requirement that we start big financial audits on things.
There'd be a savings.
Yeah, well, I wish we could guarantee that, but at this point, we can't.
And the thing we're
we don't have to grow.
Well, we're going to look. The thing I would like to. John was in a meeting this afternoon with the other manager on the other side, who gives the CNE team her six employees. When we now is that the. We're not going to quite be able to necessarily do that, especially in the summer of an even-numbered year when we're normally all 15 of us plus some temporary employees are dealing with signature verification for initiative petitions. So that's the discussion we're going to have tomorrow morning, and why John keeps saying we'll get back to you on the fiscal impact. It's not clear, but what we wouldn't have to... We've got to look at when we now augment our staff with temporary employees. I don't know that we could... have temporary employees. It's hard enough to train a full-time employee to review CNE reports in any period of time. And so that's the discussion we'll have about the workflow. Obviously, there'll be more transactions during an election cycle than
last question I have is, how do you back up the system?
Well, traditionally, with all the systems at the Secretary of State's office, they have, you know, they back up stuff frequently. I can't give you the exact answers on that.
Cause
have more, oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Before we leave the subject, I'll make it brief because I know you're anxious to get to it. The way this division has been managed is we have 15 full-time positions. Six are a manager over C&E. I have a manager over all the other functions of the office. But everybody in the office is trained to do everything because at certain times of the year, everybody needs to pitch in with certain tasks, and CNE examinations are one of them. When those deadlines are hit, everybody, no matter what their primary job is pulled off to do CNE examinations. In July of even numbered years, everybody processes petition sheets, and their primary tasks get set aside for a while. And that's why your question is a complicated one for us to get an answer to and why we need some time to try and figure it out.
Well, let's do this, colleagues. It's 7:48 in the evening. I truly appreciate all of you staying late and working through this. I will report back to Representative Kitts that we've worked through this bill. We've taken a good cut at it. And at our next meeting on... Monday the 11th, we will have a public hearing, and then we will continue to work through this bill. We probably go through it one more time, make sure we all feel comfortable, and hopefully we'll have a product that each of us will be proud of and the Secretary of State will be proud of and can work with. So we appreciate the partnership, and we appreciate staff staying so late and working with us. And with that said, we're going to adjourn for the evening.
Get to pay ourselves overtime on our campaign fund.